I can't bear a Sunday night without you.
Oh, come on,
Philip,
I fill up your tank.
Yes, you do.
Yes, you do. Because I need you several times a week.
So do I. I need you all the week. All the time.
I think you're going to come back as a penny because...
No king ever existed without the permission of the priesthood. I don't care what religion you're talking about or what period of history you're talking about, it is the truth. The kings never had the power and don't to this day. Kings exist at the whim of the real power, which is the priesthood standing behind the throne. And when the king ceased to be a benefit to the priesthood, they would simply poison him or get rid of him in some other way.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 10 past five. And welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 23rd of May 2025, streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol city centre. Don't believe a word we say. We do our best to share a few flashes of clarity, but never believe what we say. Check it for yourself. This is the whole point. You have to make up your own mind. And you have to basically, if there's something that you're a bit unsure about, go and double check it. And you know what? I make that nice and easy for people because as of the end of Sunday, there are links to almost all the stories we talk about up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So you can go and have a look for yourself and say, oh, Tony's really posted a real bum link here. Terrible. This is a load of nonsense. Or you can say, wow, that's interesting. No one ever told me that, which is, I think, in a way, could be the name of a brand new program, couldn't it? Blimey, no one ever told me that. Anyway, so we're streaming live from Bristol's the Bristol Templar Port turned merchant venturer fortress. This is our local Illuminati meeting again this week, by the way, on Thursday evening. I'm sure that will be passed back to them by the intelligence people at the City of London. They are our local Illuminati. They were set up to fund Cabot's massive trip in 1497 of a reconnaissance for genocide, where around about 100 million people, the Native Americans, were killed by the people that went over in his wake. They went over to be all nice and friendly, and then they just stuck knives in their back and stole their land. That is colonialism for you folks, and it's all still going here. In fact, although the merchant venturers were set up in the 16th century, it was actually in the 15th century that the same people financed that trip. Funny that, isn't it? So the colonialism starts here, folks. That's, of course, all part now of Tampon Charlie's Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. Nice clear page, easy to download now, available free from APK Pure or Apple App Store. But the easiest place is just go to thisweek.org.uk, and there's a bunch of links just underneath the big green download button. But don't try getting it from evil Google Play. Obviously. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust agenda, psyops bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, or boring us to tears more often with irrelevant distractions, a whole bunch of numpty celebs all over the place, or else, of course, controlled opposition. Loads and loads of that out there, the double cross system, that's cool. Go and look it up. Victor Rothschild's little brainchild in World War II, and he was working for MI5, worked rather well against the Nazis, and they're now using it against us. Puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after everyone with influence who speaks up for humanity, or against the rentiers, and we'll be hearing quite a lot about them tonight from Steve Hall, the author of The Death of the Left, but also someone I overheard recently butting in with a few questions on one of the Michael Hudson interviews. It was great to hear him chipping in with his northern accent, like, and his very good understanding of the finance. It'll be interesting to see what Martin makes of him tonight. So against the rentiers, this is what the witch hunts are going after, anyone that speaks up for humanity, or against the rentiers, World War III, or wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to multiplying crises, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, etc., etc. The twisted Armageddonist, accelerationist policies are crafted rather well, aren't they? And it's all working rather nicely to make every crisis worse. and the politicians have got nothing to say. Nick Land and his techno-behaviourist Dark Enlightenment cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their AI. Got a bit of a poem about Nick tonight. Or even dead. Albert Pike's World War III curse relies on blind obedience. I mean, who knows? It might be true. It certainly seems to be happening. The three World Wars of Albert Pike. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King and the vampire queen Carmilla wage a war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as on the British people. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, and the only right they seem interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves, with the help, like the jabs, of a doctor. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? As we learn, you learn. So helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We hope to have a guest, special guest, at 6 p.m. live. So, Martin, can you give us your take on this week's... I suppose there's various bits of... Obviously, there's lots of news. But the biggie, apparently, is this Brexit deal that they've signed at the beginning of the week on Monday. Big announcement. It's all going to be hunky-dory, and the EU can fish in British waters for another 12 years.
Well, that's one part of the deal, it's true. It's an extension of the deal that was already done by Boris Johnson's regime. And, of course, what's really... This is tying up loose ends. You know, Brexit has been carried into practice now. It turns out that we've put loads and loads of infrastructure in ports like Portsmouth to deal with, you know, the phytosanitary stuff that was, but that's all been settled because we're just going to stick to the same old EU phytosanitary rules, and therefore we don't actually need, we've actually wasted a load of money putting infrastructure into to try and get out of them, but if we couldn't get out of them anyway, but we're never going to get out of them, and we're back where we started.
You're a bit of a fan of the European Union, aren't you?
No, I'm not, Tony, but well, I'm just not a fan of Brexit.
So,
that's not
okay,
the same
okay,
thing.
Okay, so which is it that you laugh, but it's not funny, is it, really? Because the idea is that sovereignty is either with us, and you're an anarchist, or else it's with Westminster, or it's with Brussels, surely.
Sovereignty is quite a complicated concept, Tony.
Yeah, so
any trade deal
who
that we do...
Just answer that question, please. I know you'd want to go and talk about something else, but about who makes the laws?
Brussels or
Westminster?
Britain is embedded in lots of international treaties, including the UN, for example... And there are rules of being an international organisation.
We seem to take no notice.
We resigned from the EU club.
But Martin, you're shouting. Why are you shouting?
Because you're talking over me.
No, I'm trying to explain to you that there are lots of treaties that we just ignore. The UN, for example. All sorts of resolutions of the UN. We just ignore them if you feel like
it. Okay, so the real world, as we're seeing with Trump in charge in the United States, is such that in actual fact the rules-based order is now non-existent. So the World Trade Organization, which many pro-Brexit people were saying, we don't need to do a deal with the EU, we'll just use World Trade Organization rules, the World Trade Organization has been smashed by the United States, so it doesn't exist. The United Nations still exists, and it ought to be intervening in Gaza, but it isn't.
So
but
is the World Trade Organization a good thing?
Well, the World Trade Organization was an agreement.
Very good for China, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and that's why they joined it.
Now maybe they're thinking, well, actually, that wasn't such a good idea. Maybe we should bring back a bit of protectionism to make sure that we've still got our own economy.
Well, that's what Trump is trying to do. The problem is that the United States consumers need cheap Chinese stuff because they can't produce it themselves, and the trade war that Trump started has been decisively won by the Chinese already.
We are actually talking about Brexit, but we have kind of got hooked on Chinese goods, haven't we? That's the idea.
That's right.
In fact, the Brits have done this over the years. What you do is you provide it really cheap till everyone's hooked on it, and then you start jacking up the price. It's like exactly what they've done with electricity prices now. We're all reliant on electricity, so they're just starting to price fix upwards.
International trade is quite a complicated subject, Tony, and countries engage in trade deals with each other in order to make rules to govern it. But of course it is actually a struggle for power. The struggle for power by the developing countries, as China used to be, against the developed countries, the imperialist countries.
Okay.
Yeah? And, of course, that's actually a matter of
warfare.
They've
done very well.
Politics.
They've done very well. It's financial warfare, as you quite correctly said. So, anyway, what is it that makes you think that Brussels is a better place to make these rules than Westminster?
Well, the point is that the EU still exists whether we're in it or not, Tony. So we have to have some relationship with it.
Why is it better that the rules and laws that govern us are made in Brussels rather than in Westminster? I don't think it makes that much difference, personally. But
well,
what do you think?
Well, it doesn't make that much difference in the big scheme of things, but if we're going to argue about sovereignty, certain people in this country, in the Republican movement in Ireland, they don't want Westminster to tell them what to do. And they don't want anybody in Westminster to tell them what to do.
Ukraine is not in the European Union. Martin, you're shouting again.
I know,
it's very boring.
You keep provoking me.
I'm not provoking you at all. I'm just trying to get an answer from you on the question I asked you. You just keep going off in all sorts of different directions. Why is it that it's better to make these laws in Brussels than it is in Westminster? Just think of one specific thing. How on earth do you get rid of the European Commission who make the laws in Brussels? Surely at least it's easier to get rid of the MPs and the government in Westminster than it is to get rid of the European Commission.
We're not in the European Union anymore, Tony, so at the European Commission, we don't have any commissioners. We used to have, we don't have them anymore. We still, as a country, have to do deals.
Martin, you still haven't answered the question, have you? You were very pro-Brussels
anti-Brexit. I was anti-Brexit.
Yes, okay.
Because by being in the European Union, we got some kind of a say over what the European Union does.
Without shouting, can you just explain... in a nice calm manner with no shouting, why it is that it's better to have had no Brexit and how wonderful things would have been if we hadn't.
It wouldn't have been wonderful, Tony. It wouldn't have been as bad as it is. The latest estimates is we lost £27 billion of trade since 2016 and investment in this country has simply collapsed since 2016. There's been no business investment.
We were hearing just the other day on this program a couple of weeks ago. I love talking about this with you because you always start to shout and I don't know why.
Brexit, Tony.
I'm sure you are. I realise that. This is a couple of weeks ago. We had very clearly, I think it was Stephen Dorrell, explaining how the lack of investment or investment in Britain fell off a cliff after the Second World War, and it's been going down ever since. It fell off another cliff at the end of the 1970s with some sort of deal with... this is what Stephen was saying anyway, but you think it's only just fallen off a cliff when we did Brexit?
No, I'm not talking about outside foreign investment into Britain. I'm talking about investment by British capitalists in Britain.
Well, that actually wasn't allowed, was it, before Thatcher? You couldn't have foreign investment into Britain.
We did have sovereignty before Thatcher came to power in the 1970s, and what she did is she got rid of exchange controls, so then wealthy people could take their money out of the country. Now, that's the big issue. And, of course, it all ended up in the Cayman Islands and all the rest of it.
That's nothing
to do with Brussels.
It's to do with the
City of London being a money laundry.
I feel like a bit of a naughty sort of Jeremy Paxman here, just trying desperately to get you to answer the question. But anyway, I think you did eventually. Let's have a listen now to the news on Monday about this trade deal.
Kemi Badenoch has accused the Prime Minister of reopening the Brexit battles of the past and surrendering many of the gains secured by the previous government. With his assessment of how British voters now feel about Brexit, here's our Home Editor, Mark Easton.
When Britain voted to leave the European Union 9 years ago, the result mirrored a divided country, torn between contradictory national instincts, seeing ourselves simultaneously as a distinct sovereign island with control over our affairs and an outgoing, adventurous people, keen to be active players in a globalised world. This was not the Leave-Remain schism so much as a tension which has existed since the Acts of Union in 1707, when the architects of the new British state designed it to be culturally and religiously independent from continental Europe while constructing the engine for an international trading empire. Since the vote in 2016, the debate about the wisdom of Brexit has become less philosophical and more practical. A representative survey this year suggested most people who voted Remain or Leave now thought Brexit had been bad for the cost of living, bad for the NHS, bad for trade and immigration. But despite that, two-thirds of Leave voters said they would still vote to leave again. And the most powerful reason was to ensure Britain retained control over its own affairs. Reaction to today's agreement will be mixed. For some, it's about cutting through bureaucratic brambles. For others, it's about finding agreement with trading partners and security allies. but upon an island nation for a significant group, preserving the inviolability of our coastal borders will always remain the most persuasive battle cry.
Well, it's the BBC doing their best there to try and be even-handed, a reasonable job. This is basically rolling things back, Martin, isn't it? Do you think that's the right thing to do?
It's not rolling things back. There are various things that were on the table to be settled, and they've been settled so we can all move on and forget about Brexit. No, we're not going back into the European Union anytime soon. They don't want us back because we've caused such a load of bother. So we've now got to just settle various things off because we've got a world war and a banking crash to come, and Brexit is really small potatoes.
Well, the EU has been told, hasn't it, by the world, basically, look, put your money where your mouth is. The European Union is saying, oh, the Israelis have got to allow food into Gaza, and then they're just ignoring them. So what's the point of the EU?
Well, you could argue that the EU isn't a military alliance. It's basically a trade deal writ large. Alliance, what's happened? Spain, for example, and Ireland have recognised the Palestinian state. And as we discussed on the show the other week, that's quite likely the cause of the power outage in Spain. So this is what real politics is about. It's about warfare, Tony. And the EU is just a trade club.
Well, when it comes to military alliances, there's certain people very happy with this deal Starmer signed on Monday.
The Deputy First Minister, Kate Forbes, says this deal only undoes some of the damage caused by Brexit.
When we were in the European Union, we didn't have the barriers to trade, which is key to the seafood industry, which has now been unpicked to an extent in this new deal. But equally, they were able to negotiate on a regular basis, and that is what we think should happen.
But here in northeast Scotland, there are plenty of fishermen who oppose both this deal and European Union membership, which may explain why support for Reform UK has been on the rise here.
The UK government has said it will back coastal communities by investing £360 million into new technology and equipment for the fishing industry. The new Security and Defence Partnership aims to increase cooperation in areas including supporting Ukraine, security initiatives and mobility of military equipment and personnel. The partnership should also allow Britain's defence industry to bid for contracts under the EU's new €150 billion fund to strengthen the country's defence capabilities. Our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams reports.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the sheer unpredictability of Donald Trump have already brought the UK and EU closer together. Now the two sides are looking to cement this evolving relationship. Speaking in the Commons, the Defence Secretary John Healey said the partnership would enable Europe to confront the threats posed by Russia. Earlier, the President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, spoke of the deal's mutual advantages.
This joint procurement we've discussed will increase our readiness, will close military gaps that we have, and will increase our interoperability when our armed forces are going on missions together. It will create new opportunities, of course, for our defense industries, and open the option for stronger, more coordinated support for Ukraine.
The paper published today covers a host of security issues, but is little more than a framework for future cooperation. Some of the difficult stuff has yet to be negotiated, including how much of the EU's recently unveiled defence fund, worth £150 billion, will be available to British companies. The Conservatives have their doubts. James Cartledge, Shadow Secretary of State for Defence, accused the government of giving away fishing rights in exchange for what he called a glorified talking shop with not a penny of guaranteed defence funding. But David Lockwood, the boss of Babcock International, one of the UK's largest defence contractors, called today's announcement a real achievement in bolstering links with European allies.
I mean, I see the whole thing with the EU and Britain and Brexit as a sort of a ratchet, really, and it always has been ever since the days of Ted Heath and the EEC, is that you're being slowly but surely sucked into this thing, and it's only going to be a one-way street. So Brexit was an attempt to kind of break free, but effectively it's failed, and slowly but surely we're going back in, but we're going back in with none of the say, even though we didn't really have hardly anything to begin with, at all. So you're just going to have to take all these regulations from the EU, and we still have a sort of a Brexit, but it's most of the relations that we have with Europe are to do with holidays and trade, and that we don't have any control over really at all now.
The whole point of being in the EU in the first place is that we got a say in some of the rules in the EU. We didn't have, as you say, a great deal of influence, but we had some influence. So, for example, we didn't go in the euro, and they couldn't make us.
But you see, what I'm saying is, that is, you could stop the advance, but you can't go back.
Well, the problem is, it's about reality, Tony. The reality is that Britain is quite close to Europe, and geographically we are in Europe, and of course people in Ireland, for example, which are not on the same island as us, they definitely feel that they are part of Europe.
If you talk to a lot of Irish people, they will say, well, what was the point in breaking free from the British when we're now run by Brussels?
The point about all of this, Tony, is once you're outside the EU, like Albania, then you have to accept the EU's rules, but you don't get a say over it. We're not going to have the say. We're not going to have different size of screws from everybody in the EU. The regulations about things like safety for chemical industries, they will make that rule book. All that Brexit has done is we have become rule takers. You're right about that. Britain is a rule taker from the EU single market.
Well, what's this going to do?
Because there's nothing else to do.
It's only one way people's sentiments in terms of voting is going to go with this, and it's towards Farage, isn't it?
The people who are not happy with the Brexit they said they wanted will vote for Farage. But in actual fact, Farage, in a first-past-the-post system, is likely to be very, very difficult to form a government. Because lots of people, if you look at the opinion polls, it was in the BBC piece, the majority of people in this country have decided that Brexit was a bad idea. They don't want to argue about it over the Christmas dinner. Pro-Remain people like me are fed up of talking about it.
The reality is, the Europe ones that keep banging on about it.
Yeah, the European single market is not going away. And it's all about the size of screws. The trade deal that supposedly we've done with Trump just means that we won't be tariffed as badly as we would have been. So we get a good old slap and a nosebleed, but he's not going to get out the baseball bat with us. The reality is that Britain, because of Brexit and the lack of investment by local capitalists, not by foreigners, in the economy, we are one of the weakest economies in Europe.
I don't know why you don't seem to acknowledge the fact that Reform are polling so well.
I'm acknowledging that they're polling so well.
And they're probably going to form the next government.
No, they're not necessarily, Tony.
Probably. They certainly are. If you look at the polls from the... In fact, not the polls, the results from the a couple of weeks ago...
Yes, they got 30-odd percent.
They are going to form a government. They're going to have a majority. If people vote that way, they are.
Yeah, if they get... No, under a first-past-the-post system, you've got 30%, and in actual fact, the Labour Party has 25%, the Lib Dems have got 17%.
What's happening is both Tory and Labour voters are starting to vote Reform, aren't they? And now they've seen them do very well. They're thinking, well, there's no point in tactical voting.
Now,
let's just vote Reform.
Listen, if we're talking about the cephalogy of elections in Britain and whether people like Reform or not, we can talk about it all day. I'm talking about the practicalities of trade deals.
It was interesting that Nigel Farage didn't really have anything to say this week. I was quite surprised. Did you see that?
He was on holiday in France.
He's not around for this to talk about, which is quite disappointing. I was interested to hear what he had to say, not necessarily agreeing or believing it. But anyway, the phenomenon of Reform began with our first show this month, when we had these local elections where Reform did extraordinarily well, and so we need to have a real, real good look at who these people are. Now, I spoke to the author of The Death of the Left, not the greatest title, Steve, but it's a superb book, and it's got lots of economic and sociological analysis in there about what's really going on the left wing. I think he's superb at looking at which of the parties. He's actually a member of the Economics Working Group of George Galloway's Workers' Party as well. So I asked him particularly, he also talks here about Liz Truss and what brought her down, about what is going on with Nigel Farage and Reform, because loads and loads of ex-Labour voters are now voting for them.
Farage is a fake, former commodity broker in another city port, who's pretending to be a nationalist and offering something that looks vaguely, on the surface, like a neo-mercantilist package, you know, invest in Britain, but at the same time, out of the other side of his mouth, he's talking about financial flows free capital, globalism, and you know, all of the accoutrement of global finances. He's a total fake. Reformers are fake. And they've moved into the vacuum created by the complete inability of the left to do anything about the austerity programs that followed the great financial crash in 2008. But Reeves is supposed to be going over, you know, wooing Larry Fink to invest private equity. You know, well, where is it? Where are the new factories? Where are the refurbished? Where's the railway? You know, refurbished railways. Well, what's happening? Where are the wind farms? What's happening to this country? It's still suffering from disinvestment. But nobody's interested in investing here because we have very high labor costs, very high energy costs and transport costs. So they'd rather invest somewhere where costs are low. It's so simple, it's so obvious. And this is what they do. And the reform will make no difference to anything whatsoever. They'll be out another 4 or 5 years and people will be wondering why they voted for them, just like they're wondering why they voted for Starmer now. And they'll be looking for they'll wheel in the next lot of puppets to support the you know, global finance capital.
Yeah, but so if you were Reeves and you had a good set of like armed bodyguards,
I need a lot of them, you know, because they did try to shoot Roosevelt as well. You know, 16 days before his inauguration ceremony, they tried to shoot him because they knew he was going to put the clamps down on the global banking industry after they'd failed so badly in 1929. That's why he got in.
So imagine yourself sitting in number 11, and with your armed guards. What are you going to do, Steve? What should she be doing?
Well, what she should be doing is trying to set up better trading relationships with the BRICS economies, and using massive public investment. I mean, huge public investment to reboot our economy. We should nationalise railways, utilities, steel. They're in such a desperate situation that even Farage and his crew are arguing for temporary nationalisation of the steel industry to get it back on its feet. You can't run a country without steel, without a metals industry. You know, steel and aluminium, you need these things. And we need our own health care equipment. So we need judicious reindustrialization. We don't upset the Chinese. We don't be making cheap electronics goods and plastic dinosaurs for the kids that are cheaper from China. So we want decent trading relationships. And we need to reboot our economy with public investment the way the Chinese are doing it. But, of course, as soon as one single whiff of that, and the foreign exchange traders will attack and devalue the currency, because at the moment we're import dependent. We're massive.
So yeah, okay. So as Chancellor, what would you do about the city? Obviously, you can't just fiddle around.
I wouldn't get a chance because I'd be out within a month.
Well, okay. So how is it possible to do anything about the City of London? We just have to live with it.
I would like to do things with the City of London. But I don't want to talk about them now.
Right, okay.
I'd turn it into a theme park. I would actually employ some of the brighter ones, because some of them know how the system works. Hmm. They're not intellectuals, but they know how the system works. And employ some of them, give them a decent salary, and employ them in our public finance system, so that we can actually reboot the economy. I wouldn't get rid of private investment altogether. They can play catch-up if they can offer good terms, and if they can offer to small and medium enterprises and help to get the smaller businesses off the ground, then let them do it. But we need... this is the way China does, and this is the way we did it from 1945 up until the stagflation of the 1970s. The problem we had in that period was the money flowing out of the country, circumventing, avoiding capital controls through the euro-dollar market. If that had happened, if we'd invested properly like Germany did, we'd be in a much, much better situation. But we at the moment are in deep doo-doo, and we need to do something quite serious to leave ourselves out.
But that's not happening, is it? As you've just explained, what do you make of the whole business with Liz Truss then? Did you think she actually was onto doing something fairly sensible and was bounced out by the city?
No, but that's not why they got rid of her. The reason they got rid of her was that she threatened to use public and a lot of public money to tide people over the difficult period that would obviously transpire as she was trying to woo private investment with tax cuts. So if you cut the tax, of course, you've got to issue more money to pay people benefits and try and stop them rioting in the streets. So she was doing, it was a stupid idea, trying to woo private capital into a country with high labour and high transport and energy, massive energy, with the highest energy costs in Europe, would never have worked. But that's not why they attacked her. They attacked her because they knew she would use public investment, use public money, I beg your pardon, sovereign currency to tide us over. If a socialist government got in and promised to do exactly the same for a sensible programme, like public investment, nationalisation, and also boosting effective demand so small businesses could start operating again, and increase confidence in small business, then they would do exactly the same. They would attack and they would, devalue our currency, cause inflation. The bond vigilantes would attack. But we don't need the bonds. We don't need to sell bonds, technically. When the central bank, of course, can buy them back. They're not the real problem. The real problem are the Forex traders. Don't forget, we're up against a monster, Tony. In the bond markets, the Forex markets and the stock markets that trade over $160 trillion worth of currency every day. That's the size of the monster. I call it the Death Star. It's circulating around the world. And it can pounce on anyone who does the wrong thing. And we're up against a massive, powerful enemy. And we need to do some serious stuff. And the way that I think with the Chinese model works, we're obviously in a different situation. We don't have a huge manufacturing base. So we'd have to think our way through that. But we need some serious politics to take on the Death Star. And I don't see any of the parties even anywhere close to the sort of policies we need to reboot our economy and put our nation back on its feet.
So is that how you see it, Martin, the Death Star, he puts it as there?
I'm pretty much in agreement with most of that, actually. But I think what will happen is that the Death Star will implode in... It will implode itself.
Why? Because it can keep itself alive.
No, it can't. Yeah. They're running out. They've been printing money and propping up property values and stock market values for years now, since 2008. But they're running out of road.
I would suggest they just make up money. They just make up money and lend it to themselves, even give it to themselves in order to keep themselves going. They're now in a position, and of course, Mark Carney was the boss of the Financial Stability Committee, the Regulation Committee of World Banking at the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. Oh, and by the way, it's interesting, he talks about the city a bit there, and the city is, as he says in the longer interview, which will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, Steve is saying that this is a separate country, and has been since medieval times. The same exact thing is true of the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. So England and Switzerland are sort of almost like two sides of the same coin, one for Britain, Europe, and world trade in London, in the city, and the other one, of course, is the regulator of all the banks, the central banks in the entire world, all centred around these two countries. Funny, the flag is a reverse, one is a reverse of the other as well. But we also heard last week, I mean, he's talking about Goldman Sachs there, talking about these massive amounts of trades being done by these people. They're a very powerful institution, aren't they? They seem to be sort of basically in the driving seat. I can remember at the Bilderberg conference back in 2016, I think it was in Dresden, meeting up with the guy who from Goldman Sachs who had sponsored Obama and Clinton, given the money for their campaign. So these people just buy politicians.
Well, they do, but I think capitalism has got an inherently contradictory system. The creation of these huge financial flows and derivatives betting, which is what it is, has created a massive bonfire. And at some point, all of these financial instruments will be liquidated. It'll be a major crash.
And I think
they know it's going to happen. They will do it.
It's happened in 1929, didn't it?
Well, in 1929, what happened is that the stock market crashed of its own volition.
How I understand it. It was something called call money in 1929. This is in the film The Money Masters. He talks a lot about that. Bill Still does, and explains that it was deliberate because this is money which is used to roll debts over through the night into the next day, and suddenly somebody just switched the tap off saying you can't have any. So this is what caused the crash.
In 1929?
Yeah. Right. So it was deliberate. It was someone somewhere in Wall Street pressed the button and said, right, we're going to have a crash now. And they could do exactly the same today. That's what I'm
Well, I think there are two ways that crashes can happen. One is they happen spontaneously because capitalism is an anarchic, contradictory system. Yeah. And we've seen booms and busts throughout the history of capitalism. It's what capitalism does. It booms and then it busts.
I mean, it could be
and
in the software, couldn't it? I mean, the trading software.
Yes, it could. And, of course, what's now happening, look at what Trump's done with his tariff farrago. He has actually basically wobbled the whole of the world's financial system. Nobody knows now what the rules are. And we're not going back to any kind of trading system where everybody knows what the rules are going to be. That is going to have a massive effect on confidence, the animal spirits of investors. They're already basically preparing to jump ship when the Western capitalist system crashes. The question is, will the Chinese and the Russians follow us into the black hole? And the answer at this stage in 2025, in my opinion, is they won't. We will have a crash. They will not. And at the end of all of that, there'll be a war, which the West will lose, and then the BRICS, Russia and China in the lead, will then rule the world.
Well, maybe everyone will lose.
Well, of course, if we all get killed, which is the most likely outcome, we're all going to lose.
So it's not quite that simple. So, you're talking about these financial markets being a bit of a game just now. I mean, what's the point in playing that game? What's the point in trying to outcompete China in trade? What is the point? Pointless.
Well, the point is there's absolutely perfectly straightforward ways in which countries can collaborate to win-win benefits, as the Chinese keep pointing out. Just because if we've got more consumers in China, because our living standards are improving, you can sell us stuff. Why not? Yeah. The Chinese economy is what kept the Western economies afloat after 2008. They stimulated their economy and that kept the whole thing going. Otherwise, it would fall off the cliff.
Trump has bounced the Chinese into a better deal.
No, he hasn't. The Chinese have refused everything he said and they've had to back down. Oh, that's what's happened.
I thought that's what happened.
Well, no, we never know because Trump's changed his mind now. He changes his mind every day.
You just hate Trump, don't you? Anyway, I don't hate him.
What he has done, he's a disruptor. We are never
he
going.
He doesn't really know what he's doing.
No, he doesn't. That's right. That's the issue. What he's done is he's wrecked all effective trade agreements. He's just wrecked them. So there aren't any more.
But at
so
least there's not everyone for himself. Isn't he? There's not missiles being fired into nuclear Russia anymore. And at least there was a short ceasefire. So we'll see what happens. We'll be looking at Gaza again in a minute.
Well, it was only the Russians on ceasefire in Ukraine.
Yeah. But at least we're not... Well, I don't know if you remember, Martin, before Christmas, we had US and British missiles being fired into Russia. That's what I just said. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Right. And isn't it the Oreshnik, this amazing Russian missile coming back and hitting some big NATO base somewhere in...
No, it's a big factory.
Wasn't it some sort of arms base?
Yes, it was an arms factory.
Controlled by NATO, even though they don't like to admit it, and it was completely destroyed. So the Oreshnik is a bit of a weird one. It's almost like a sort of missile which fires through the air, and then it kind of hovers over the target and sends down like tens of different missiles to completely destroy a whole like 3 or 4 mile square area. I don't know if the NATO has got anything like that.
No, they haven't. The good news is that from a military point of view, NATO is snookered. But the problem is that I've just been reading John Mearsheim's book, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, is we ought to be able to prevent World War III because it's such a disaster. There's no reason why relatively democratic Russia and modernising China and the liberal West have to fight at all. There's plenty of common ground. There's plenty of things we could do. We could work together. If the Chinese want to put railways in Africa, well, that's an opportunity for British firms to sell things in Africa, isn't it?
We don't want to fight, but by jingo, if we do. So we don't want to, but actually we do. It seems that Britain does want to fight. In fact, they've got this whole system of conflict initiation that Britain seems to be involved in, as well as the US and the EU behind the scenes. Now, I don't know if you remember last week's interview with Pierre Jovanovic, who is a fascinating bloke, a brilliant book. It's only in French, which is a pity. I suppose you could kind of put it through some kind of electronic mincing machine, which would turn it into English. But he's done a superb job. And clip that we're going to play, a clip now that I didn't play last week from the interview I did with him, which is about Goldman Sachs, because with lots and lots and lots of roads lead back to Goldman Sachs, I think it would the world would get immensely lighter if every single senior executive of Goldman Sachs and major shareholder was arrested, put in prison, and said, well, if you tell us all about all the bad things you've done, we might let you out. Let's have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The world would suddenly get a bit lighter. I mean, of course, they would probably want to press their Death Star button and destroy the whole lot of us, because that's the way they seem to operate. But anyway, he was saying that actually gold is one of the things these bankers fear. And one of the reasons they don't want us to turn our savings into gold is, or one of the proofs of it, is the fact that the banks are making it more and more difficult for people to withdraw the money that they actually have saved in the past.
Gold is a problem for all the governments, because when you withdraw your money, or when you buy some gold, they cannot take it from you. That's the point. You know, here in France, you know, if you want to withdraw, let's say, 3,000 euros, you know, they will ask you to write a letter to certify that you was sane, you know, in your mind. I will give you an example. One of my acquaintances, he was an engineer. He was decorated with two other guys for the invention of internet by the Queen Elizabeth. He received his prize, and basically he wanted to take like 500 or 600 euros, and the banker, it was a lady, she told him, "You are too old. You don't need that money." Can you believe this?
Well, they're obviously making some changes to try to stop people getting their wealth that they've saved. So, this book of yours, 2008, is it available in English?
Not yet. It's even not available in French yet.
So, anyway, so if people are interested in following your work, reading up on this, can they find anything in English about it?
Unfortunately not. It's only in French. It's quotidien.com. It's a tremendous job, even in French, to follow all this.
No. Okay. Well, what about your list? Because that seems to be one of the most interesting things here, is your list of criminal bankers.
This list is public, you know, there is nothing new, but what I'm showing in the book is that these people did it on purpose, which is totally different. This is totally different. They did it on purpose.
How do you prove that?
Very simply. There was a French trader at Goldman Sachs, Fabrice Tour, he went in Europe. He met with Belgian banks, Spanish, French banks, etc., and he was selling them a piece of beep, and we know it because all the internal mail from Goldman Sachs went public when the senators made their investigation. But what I did is that I went into the 800 something pages of this investigation, and I read a lot of mails from Goldman Sachs, and these people knew perfectly that the products they are selling to retirement companies in England, in Belgium, in France, they were just going to blow up 6 months later. Mm. And they knew it.
So that's interesting, isn't it? Goldman Sachs, he had a whistleblower trader, his name being Fabrice Tour, That's T-O-U-R-R-E. So I don't know if there's any interviews with him around. It'd be interesting to hear from him, Martin, ex-Goldman Sachs trader. He blew the whistle, and a lot of these emails have now been published, and he's got some of them in his book saying, look, we'll just sell on this stuff, this bleep, this nonsense, this rubbish, these financial products that are designed to blow up in their faces in a few weeks' time. So this is a crime, isn't it?
Well, it should be a crime. And of course,
but it is a crime. It's just not being prosecuted.
Yes, I mean Peter Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous U.S. economist. He's at the University of Austin in Texas, and he was saying that what should happen after a crash like that is the people that were deliberately selling stuff they knew to be rubbish should be prosecuted, sent to prison, you know, not fined, imprisoned, and their assets need to be seized. And if you do that, then they won't do it again. But what actually happened, of course, is because the banking system is too big to fail, the rest of the population was put on the hook for all of their bad trades, and the banks were rescued, and in actual fact, the people in charge of the banks got wealthier than they would otherwise have been.
What about the poor old whistleblowers? Because in 2013, 1st of August, there's a news story. Ex-Goldman Sachs trader Fabrice Touré is liable in a $1 billion fraud. So he was then prosecuted for selling the mortgages. Actually, what he was doing was just trying to tell the public, we were being told to sell these mortgages, and we knew they were fraudulent. And it wasn't just me, but he was the only one that was actually prosecuted because he blew the whistle.
Well, the way it works is if you grass up the scam, then you get thrown under the bus.
You know, this reminds me a bit of Tom Hayes. Do you remember Rain
Man?
Yes, Rain Man. He was at Credit Suisse, I think, when it was a LIBOR trader.
Yeah, it was Lloyds, wasn't it?
Whose dad was a former World in Action producer. And Tom Hayes got the same thing. You know, he's trying to blow the whistle, and what happens is that the legal system comes to get him and leaves everybody else who never blew the whistle to walk the streets with all that money coming out of their pockets.
Have you ever watched the film The Big Short? Which is about, you know, the people who guessed that there was the bubble was a bubble, and they took long-range bets. There were, you know, the film's all about them. It's a kind of a bit of a jokey film, actually, where they talk to the camera and say what they're thinking about. But it's quite a good summary of what happened. And at the very end of the film, the guy played by, can't remember who played him, but, you know, he basically predicted that there was going to be a crash, and he'd bet on the crash, and he'd left working for the mainstream bank so he could bet on that there was going to be a crash, and then the crash happened, and he made loads of money. Anyway, the guy that used to employ him from one of the mainstream banks took him out for lunch and said, well, you've made a name for yourself, you guessed it all right, and how much are you worth now? And the guy said, oh, he's worth so much. Well, he said, well, I'm worth twice as much as that for getting it wrong. So who's a mug, you or me? And that's the problem. What should have happened when the banks collapsed is they should have been nationalised, and the people in charge of them should have been sent to prison. But they weren't, and therefore they just actually ended up better off than they were before. And the disaster capitalism aspect of this is that we can now smash the welfare state in all these different countries because we can just say we've got no money because we've just stolen it all.
Well, as Steve's explained there, what he would do, Steve Hall I was talking about, is you can actually just print money and spend it into the economy through the poor, and they will use it and they will spend it, and their living standards will increase, the poverty will reduce. This seems to be a kind of secret agreement between Labour and Conservative at the moment, that they're never going to allow that to happen.
Yes, because what's happened, particularly even more so in the US, is that nobody can get into a position of political power without money, because you need money to win elections, and the people with the money then insist that no possibility of this kind of programme is allowed. I mean, the Corbyn programme, the manifesto, had all this kind of stuff in it, but of course he wasn't allowed to put it into practice because they make sure you can't. Ultimately, the crash will come, whether deliberate or accidental. They may want to have a deliberate crash that they will control, but of course the Chinese or the Russians may decide that they're going to crash it first, because if it's wobbly, anybody can knock it over.
Okay, well, look, before we leave home news, let's have a look at this announcement yesterday about... And I really... This got my back up when I heard this. They're talking, Martin, about chemical castration. What do you make of that? Is it a good idea to castrate people chemically? Rather than people in prison? Our prisons are full, apparently.
Well, I think the obvious thing to do is the prisons are full, and you've still got more prisons. You need to build some prisons. public investment. Building new prisons can put builders to work, can't it?
Yeah, well, that's true. So let's have a listen to, now to this whole concept of chemical castration.
The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has set out plans to overhaul the use of prisons in the criminal justice system after an independent sentencing review. The changes, intended to reduce overcrowding in jails, include making some prisoners in England and Wales eligible for early release after serving just a third of their sentences. The inquiry was carried out by the former Conservative Justice Secretary, David Gawk. Here's our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
For the government, this is a simple equation. Reduce the population of prisons or the criminal justice system crashes. The Justice Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, said she would accept most of the recommendations made in the review, including exploring whether chemical castration for sex offenders could be made mandatory, though that could face a legal challenge. She said a prisoner's release date is set to be more dependent on behaviour, and that many offenders could be freed after serving just a third of their sentence if they engage with rehabilitation. She agreed that jail terms under 12 months should only be used in exceptional circumstances.
The review recommends a reduction in short sentences, not abolition. It is right that judges retain the discretion to hand them down in exceptional circumstances. In considering exceptional circumstances, we will continue to ensure courts have access to thorough risk assessments for domestic abuse and stalking cases.
However, she rejected the review's recommendation to cut the minimum prison term for extended determinate or fixed length sentences to 50%. The serious violent and sexual offenders serving these sentences will have to serve at least two-thirds of their sentence, and release will continue to be a decision for the parole board. The Shadow Justice Secretary, Robert Jenrick, was not impressed.
What do these changes amount to? A get-out-of-jail-free card for dangerous criminals. Has the Justice Secretary even gone through a court listing recently? Pick one. Anywhere in our country. Those currently going to jail for 12 months or less are not angels.
The plans will put more pressure on an already overstretched probation service, which will have to monitor more released offenders in the community. The government said there would be more funding, but there are still concerns as to how it will cope with tens of thousands of additional tagged offenders. Martin Jones is His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Probation.
There's a lot that I would welcome in this review. The probation service currently is under huge pressure, so something needs to change. And if you look at the evidence, what you will find is actually a well-funded probation service which has the resources it needs will ensure that we have safer communities. But it is about ensuring that we have that scrutiny on the detail of how they're going to implement that.
Right, so that's the news report on this idea of chemical. I mean, it seems a little bit of a Nazi thing to do, doesn't it? You know, let's inject them with something which means that they're not interested in having sex anymore. This isn't really justice, is it, surely?
Well, I must say I'm inclined to agree with you, Tony, but I can imagine some people might voluntarily say, well, if I'm going to get parole or whatever, then I might submit to this, you know, as a deal, if you see what I mean. Because some people just can't help their sexual behaviour, but it may probably, if they were given some kind of injection, then they could probably
what
be...
What can't they help? They can't help raping women?
No, well, I'm just saying... Some people have very, very wayward sexual behaviour. That's why we've got people in prison.
Could just move on and have a look at the Richie Allen show. That's also happened this week. So I know Vernon was on the Richie Allen show. And Martin, he's been arrested this week. Do you know anything about Richie Allen? Do you ever listen to
him? Well, I mean, we've had him on this show, haven't we? So I've obviously spoken to him when he's been on our show.
What do you think about the state of censorship today?
Well, it's obviously there is a huge effort to control narratives by the deep state because of everything that's going on.
What about the UK Lawyers for Israel? Could possibly be them, maybe?
Well, I mean, they're very active. I mean, did you see the UK Lawyers for Israel last week came out, some of their top people coming out and saying the non-provision of food to the people in Gaza is actually a benefit to them because before the war there was a problem with obesity in Gaza, and he actually came out with that as some kind of serious comment.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to Richie's statement that he made yesterday.
They will respect the bail terms, but I know for a fact that this obviously won't go anywhere, and when it is dropped, that's when I'll be able to speak completely freely about it. and say exactly what happened and when. And I will do that when the police have said we're not going to take it any further. And that's all I can say right now. But engaging in wild speculation and saying it was this group of people or that group of people is unhelpful. I am in no position to confirm or to deny or, and I wouldn't in any case, because it would be completely improper for me to do that. The shocking nature of it is that a party in the UK in 2025, any party, by party I mean group, I mean organisation, I mean individual, any party can make wild allegations about somebody, somebody of my stature. But what do I mean by stature? Well, I'm a well-known and popular independent news producer. And what doesn't make me any more less or more likely to break the law than a private individual? Of course not. But you don't have to look very hard at me as a person to understand that I wouldn't be in the business of intimidating or harassing anybody. Anyway, it's with the police now who will be making further inquiries into the allegation. And as I communicated to the police yesterday, hopefully inquiries into the party that made the allegation, the substance of those allegations and the absence of any proof. And that's all I can say. So I'll say no more on it. I'll leave it there. Just to reiterate, I wasn't on air yesterday because an hour and a quarter before I entered the studio, I was arrested and taken into custody. And I was told that a allegation of intimidation and harassment had been made against me. And that's how it is. Sometime around 9 p.m. last evening, I got home. This isn't pleasant, of course. Decidedly inconvenient and somewhat embarrassing for somebody who's never been in any, who's never had any dealings with the law. Somewhat embarrassing to be confronted with that reality yesterday. But it is what it is. And now I just have to let it run its course. And it does me no good. It doesn't do anybody any good speculating about the nature of the party who made the allegations against me. It's just ridiculous. I'm never going to give any clues to the identity of the party that made the allegation. Of course I'm not. As I said, it would be improper. And when it comes to a conclusion, I'll be able to say more. And that's it, really. So enjoy your Thursday.
So that's Richie Allen. So all we know really is he's been arrested for harassment. He doesn't want to say what it's all about. He's not allowed to say what it's all about because of the injunction that there is. Or actually, no, I think it's just bail conditions. But there we go. And one of the guests on there, I hope it's not the reason why he was arrested, was a chap called Dr. Vernon Coleman. Now, I'm sure anyone all the way through from 2020, right the way through, will who've been paying attention will have seen Vernon Coleman. They probably either love him or hate him. We were playing many of his excerpts on this programme, and Dr. Vernon Coleman joins me on the line now. Hi, Vernon.
Hello there. Hi, Tony.
Right. Now, reason I've wanted to have a chat to you is you just got a new book out, which is a bit of a depressing title, a bit like Steve Hall we had on earlier on, who's written a book called The Death of the Left. You've written one called The End of Medicine. What do you mean by the end of medicine?
It's very simple. What's happened is that the medical establishment, which is one of the most dangerous groups of people on the planet, the medical establishment around the world has decided global warming is real, even though anyone with a brain that it's just a pseudo-scientific cult, and they've put it above the interests of patients. The result of this is that the practice of medicine has changed quite dramatically, and the welfare of patients has been pushed into second place behind global warming. And as a result of that, everything about medicine has changed, and it's changed in a way which is going to result in a massive number of patients suffering, becoming ill, and dying. There's never been anything like this. It is truly the end of medicine, as we always thought of it, whereby doctors looked after patients and did their best for them. Now, doctors are putting their priorities, putting global warming as their priority, and patients come second.
Well, you know, when I first saw the title, my immediate thoughts were, this must have something to do with assisted dying. So what do you make of that? This is another way where you're going in. I mean, doctors, I thought the idea was do no harm. And now apparently doctors are able to say to their patients, don't you think it'd be a good idea if you just took a pill and off and topped yourself?
I've been campaigning since against euthanasia for years. And let's face it, this is actually euthanasia. There are a whole host of reasons why it's dangerous. If you look what's happening in Canada, people who are poor, people who are disabled, people who are merely miserable, people who are depressed, they're all being allowed to line up for the death camps, the death room. The problem, of course, is that the patients themselves can't kill themselves. They can't give themselves an injection. So actually it's a doctor or somebody, maybe not even a doctor, somebody who's hired to do the killing, who will do the killing. This is state-organized killing. And it is, I suppose it does fit in with the end of medicine, because it's the whole destruction of the relationship between the doctor and the patient. You can't have doctors going around saying to their patients, oh, well, there's not much we can do for you. Would you like us to kill you? That really doesn't work. And the problem is, this is just one small part of what I think, or what I know, is the whole destruction of medical care. If you will know, of course, that doctors, by and large now, most of them, don't like to actually see patients. They certainly don't visit patients at home. I was a GP not all that long ago, well, a few decades ago, and I used to visit patients at home. In the daytime, at night time, weekends, Christmas Day, that was the way it worked. But now doctors don't do any visiting, and worse still, they don't even see patients. They like to do everything on the telephone, although now it's not called a telephone call, it's called a virtual appointment. And what you get is the doctor, you ring the doctor, or the doctor rings you back, and he asks you some questions. Now, however good the questions might be, you cannot examine a patient over the telephone. You can't listen to their chest, you can't listen to their heart, you can't take their pulse, you can't look down their throat, you can't look into their eyes, you can't look into their ears, you can't stick fingers into the orifices that doctors have always stuck fingers into quite usefully. You can't do anything. All you can do is provide some sort of superficial reassurance, probably useless, probably dangerous. And they're extending that now to virtual wards. And patients, instead of going into hospital, heaven forbid, patients are being given a telephone call, and they're being treated and looked after while they're at home. Now that sounds, when you think about it, that sounds as if it might be quite good. But it isn't, because the patients aren't linked up to the hospital. What they get is somebody from the hospital rings up and says, are you okay? And the patient, being a polite person, says, yes, I'm all right, thanks. And the doctor says, good, thanks, bye. And that's it. But your consultation lasts less time than a wrong number. The number of things that are happening is quite extraordinary. For example, a lot of people who have asthma will know that their doctor has said, those old inhalers that you were using, they're really bad for the climate. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you something new. It's a nice new drug that contains a steroid. And if anybody knows anything about medicine, they'll know that giving loads and loads of children and asthmatics a regular doses of a steroid inhaler isn't necessarily the best thing in the world to do, but it's probably a better for the climate, so they say. Better in some way to preventing global warming, which doesn't exist anyway. So all of these things are happening. And the big medical organizations are all joined in changing medicine. It's all happening very quietly. A lot of people don't even know that it's happening. The World Health Organization issued a list of instructions for doctors. My favorite one on the list was to doctors, this was, from the WHO, don't debate the science. Don't debate the science with patients. Well, of course they don't want to debate the science, because once they start debating the science, they'll look like complete idiots, and the whole thing will fall apart, because there isn't any science. The science is all the other way. The science simply shows that weather changes, and it, in fact, it's getting cooler, not warmer, which is why they had to change it from global warming to climate change. The problem that we've got is that the medical establishment, for whatever reason, and personally, I think it's all tied in with the depopulation plan, which is quite well proven and established. It's all tied in with that because they know damn well that if they withdraw proper medical care, which is what they're doing, then an awful lot of people are going to die. And the whole argument of the fake COVID pandemic, which I first started to expose in February and March of 2020 for my sins, that whole fake pandemic was designed to bring in the COVID vaccine, which was, in my opinion and in the opinion of quite a number of people, the most toxic product ever produced.
Well, look, Vernon, can I just ask you about another aspect of all of this, which is my experience recently. A friend of mine went into hospital. The medical staff and a particularly some kind of sister in charge of the ward seemed to be very reluctant to allow the relatives and friends in to see the patient. And also, in that particular operation, they were using fentanyl. And the fentanyl wasn't doing anything. They were using fentanyl more and more, and this individual was in a lot of pain. And eventually, they had to themselves say, look, I'm in pain. And finally, they eventually started and used some morphine, which sorted the whole thing out. So there seems to be a sort of political correctness where everybody knows in the medical books that this morphine or whatever is the right thing to use. But someone somewhere down the line has said, we'd rather use this stuff instead. And, of course, if you're using something, a different product, then that's a different company which is getting the benefit of the spending on these drugs. So there seems to be quite a lot of interference in all the sort of medical ethics of people going into hospital at all.
Absolutely. And, in fact, they don't really want people to go into hospital, which is one of the reasons why waiting lists have been allowed to get so enormously long in Britain. Britain, waiting lists are fairly unique to Britain, and they're unique because we have a very strange system. This is how they originated. Consultants in the NHS, in the National Health Service, are allowed to see patients privately if they agree to a 9/11 contract. The other 2/11 of their time they can spend with private patients. And as a consultant told me, nearly 60 years ago now, he said, if you do not keep your NHS waiting list long, who the devil is going to pay you to go privately? So that's what's been happening for all of those years, and that's one of the main reasons why the NHS is crumbling. There are lots of other reasons. But to go back to the point you were making about drugs, that's exactly right. That's the thing I was talking about with the asthma drugs. The same thing's happening with antibiotics. Doctors don't like prescribing antibiotics because it's bad for the climate. And as a result, if you look at the figures for the number of people dying from sepsis, they're rocketing. Gases used in anaesthetics have been changed. No one's really tested to see whether the new anaesthetic drugs that they're using are as good or better than the ones that they've been using for decades. It's just that the ones that they've been using for decades are apparently bad for global warming. The reason I mentioned vaccines earlier on is because vaccines, mass vaccination, is part of the future. What they want to do is to replace the drugs that have been used, many of which are very good. I have been the first to complain about drugs for ever and a day, because of the problems that they can produce. But on the other hand, if you don't prescribe antibiotics, more people will die of infections. If you don't prescribe the right asthma drugs, more people will get serious asthma, and so on and so on. But doctors, led on by the drug companies, can see the vast amounts of money and the very little work involved. Instead of giving people drugs, you just vaccinate them all the time against everything. And remember that GPs don't actually give the vaccines themselves. They get someone to do it for them. The average GP, by the way, now works in Britain, now works 23 hours a week. 23 hours a week is the average working week of a GP. And there are reasons for that. But the problem is that the doctors know that it's a very good way to make a stonking good living. I worked out that during the COVID pandemic, the average GP was making 50 grand a year by telling nurses or wherever else, somebody with a white coat, to give COVID jabs to people from the fees that they were getting, the massive fees they were getting as being encouraged to give COVID jabs. I get invitations to have the COVID jab.
Well, look, I mean, this is a whole other question, isn't it? In a way, it's a sort of sociological, philosophical question about why people become doctors. I mean, people do they become a doctor because they like the idea of having a lifetime career where you're helping other people get well who are sick, or do you do it because you've got big pound signs in your eyes?
The problems all changed 50 years ago. There were all sorts of things that changed. One of the things that changed, and I'm wary about saying this because people will jump on me and say I'm being sexist. I'm not. Exactly the opposite. In about 50 years ago, it was decreed that there should be more women doctors. Now, there was no logical reason for this apart from the obvious there should be more women. Nobody was saying there should be more male ballet dancers or there should be more male postmasters or whatever. They just said there should be more women doctors. Now, the consequence of this has not been, I'm not saying that women doctors care less or work less, but the whole enrollment at medical school system changed, and people students were chosen according to their sex more than anything else, because they had to fill up the number of female students. And what they knew at the time was that a lot of those women doctors would want to work part-time, which is one of the main reasons why doctors work an average of 23 hours a week. It's because a lot of them are women, and they don't want to work a full week for whatever reasons. They don't want to pay the tax, they want to look after their kids, they want to do something else. Doesn't matter. The point is that everything changed. And at that point, 50 years ago, when they changed the rules about medical schools, it was not long after that that they changed the rules about how general practice operated. And the rules about general practice, previously, GPs had been on a 365-day, 24-hour-a-day responsibility for their patients. That changed very quickly. And doctors were given the option of just working an ordinary 40-hour week, or as it happens, a 23-hour week. And the result of that, of course, has been a massive pressure on hospitals, because accident and emergency units can't cope, because 3 o'clock in the morning, little Johnny develops a pain from an earache. You can't ring the GP anymore. People used to just ring the GP, he'd toss around, give an appropriate treatment, little Johnny would be fine, and the doctor would go back to bed, and the patients would be happy. Now, little Johnny's mom and dad wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning because little Johnny's screaming, and they put him in the car, or they ring an ambulance, and they take him to the accident and emergency department to be treated. And that's why there are massive queues, and people in the waiting in the accident and emergency units can wait days, especially if they're elderly, because anyone over 70 is given negative priority. So even if you've got a broken leg or a broken arm, if you're old, you just have to wait and wait and wait. The ambulance services can't cope because of the massive increase in the number of people wanting to be taken to hospital, many of whom could be treated quite successfully by their GP if the GP were available, which he's not because there isn't any nighttime or weekend service. This has been happening for some time. It's not new. It's the destruction of medical care. It's a total destruction, and it's been accelerated in the last couple of years,
Dave?
Very late, by the deliberate decision to put global warming first and patients second.
Well, look, Vernon, when I think of you, I think of my sort of hero doctors, really, people who've actually spoken, the sort of doctor that I would actually like to have as my GP, because I think, I'm not quite sure who it was, but recently we asked, I think it was Dr. Bob Gill in London, we asked him about how do you tell if your GP is actually switched on or not, or if they're just following what they're told through various medical journals. And he said the best thing to do is you can ask them about ivermectin. And that's one of the simple things to do, to ask them about that. And if they say, well, yes, this is actually quite useful in respiratory diseases like COVID, but the government suppressed it, you know, you've got a live one. And if they say it's a horse dewormer, then you know you may as well get a new GP. But anyway, one of the other doctors, not in a GP in this case, as far as I know, that stands out for me right the way through the COVID business is this guy, Dr. Andrew Wakefield. I wonder what you make of him, Vernon.
The paper that got him into trouble with the General Medical Council, the paper that was in the Lancet, it was about MMR. I believe the argument was that vaccines can be related to autism and to a whole host of other diseases, and that they damage the immune system. I can't remember precisely what Andrew Wakefield said, but he got vilified inevitably because the medical establishment, the General Medical Council, leaps on anybody who dares to say vaccines are bad. And indeed, the whole establishment, the whole media. The BBC actually said, we do not interview anyone who criticizes vaccines or vaccination, whether they're right or wrong. The establishment, the General Medical Council, the BBC, the mainstream media, the government, everybody loves vaccines. But if you look at a chart of death rates from things like whooping cough or almost any other disease that you can think of, the death rates fell before the vaccines were introduced. The vaccines didn't stop those diseases. Those diseases were already being stopped by better food, better water, and so on.
Well, one of the points that Wakefield makes is, particularly with the MMR, with diseases like mumps and measles, is what the vaccine does is totally counterproductive, because it only works for a certain number of years, and it means that if and when you do get measles and mumps, it's later in life where it's actually much more dangerous. It's far better to have it when you're younger. And of course, we've got this massive cocktail of different vaccines which was being injected into newborn children now, if the mums will allow it. And I can remember myself as a reporter back in the 1990s at the BBC interviewing people about Gulf War syndrome, and the most useful conclusion that the various people who'd looked into that, including people who'd suffered with it, had said was, well, we got all these jabs when we went out to the Gulf, we got lots of them all together. And of course, you can have one jab which has been tested and safe, but if you're getting 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 jabs, and now we seem to be, Vernon, doing this to newborn babies.
They are. By the time a kid goes to school, they've had, I don't know how many jabs. To go back to what you were saying about getting infections better when you're younger, when I was a kid, mothers had chickenpox parties. One kid got chickenpox, they had a party, all the other kids went along, so they'd get chickenpox then. That was the way it was dealt with, and it was much more effective. The problem with vaccines, as you said, they're being hammered into people. And they're being hammered into people of all ages now. It's not just children. As I said, I get heaven knows how many invitations by mail, phone, text, email to go along and have my whatever the latest vaccine for old folk is. But there's never been any tests done to see whether it's safe to have 10, 20, 30.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's another aspect to all of this, and that is consent. You know, maybe nobody should be ever given a vaccine until they reach the age of 18 or 21 where they can actually give proper consent for it. I mean, how can you say when you get to 18, oh, I didn't really want all those vaccines that were given to me when I was a tiny tot?
The problem is nowadays that the whole system is pro-vaccine, and parents who say, I don't want to have my child vaccinated, are quite likely to have social workers come around, policemen come around, and have their child taken off them. And there's another thing as well. These things just keep banging into my head, but there's another thing as well. You think of the number of children who were on drugs of one sort or another, for whatever, ADHD or asthma or whatever. No one's done any tests to see what the interaction effect is between all those vaccines that they're having and the drugs that they're taking. It's hardly surprising that there's an enormous amount of illness around. It's hardly surprising that cancer amongst young adults is massively increasing. They look at all the possible things that they can blame for it, and some of them are quite absurd. They never, ever, ever look to see whether it could be vaccines that are causing all these cancers, to see whether it could be vaccines that are causing all the other problems that are affecting people, or whether vaccines could be affecting the immune system, which they damn well are.
Well, there's another sort of bit of a hero, if I can invoke a few of these people. His name is Dr. Chris Exley. He's known as Dr. Aluminium. And I interviewed him during, I think it was around about 2021, and he explained that aluminium is used in all these, many of these vaccines. They call them vaccines. Some of them really aren't. You just call it a COVID jab if it's an mRNA jab. It's not really a vaccine at all. And his argument was that actually a lot of this is toxic to you and it stays in your body. Your body can't really get rid of it unless you've got the right sort of minerals to get rid of, which are difficult to obtain. And that, again, this is potentially going to give you Alzheimer's when you're older, unless you're able to deal with that. So this is another aspect to it all, isn't it? That you've got doctors like him that have been researching this, and then funnily enough, Keele University say, oh, actually, we're getting money from other companies that are getting a lot more than for you, and they have asked us to get rid of you. I don't think they actually said that, but it was pretty clear that he was kicked out of Keele University because the university itself wanted funding from the pharmaceutical industry.
The pharmaceutical industry is enormously powerful. I've been having a running battle, pretty one-sided, I'm afraid, for most of my life when I was attacking the drug industry when I was a medical student, because it didn't seem to me that what they were doing was right and proper. And it sort of seemed that doctors had been bought and were lock, stock and barrel. My first book in 1975 was called The Medicine Then, about the influence of the pharmaceutical industry on doctors. And since then, I've had a big circle on my back, which they've been firing at regularly. It's the pharmaceutical industry that has been very much behind the banning. I'm banned from all social media, from doing videos on virtually anywhere, all mainstream media, and that can be traced back basically to the pharmaceutical industry. They just shut up anybody that they don't approve of, anybody who says things which criticize their products, because they don't like anybody criticizing their products. And if you look at the amount of billions of dollars in compensation that drug companies have had to pay, it's phenomenal. And you can look at almost any vaccine that they produce, making massive profits out of it. And you look at the side effects that have been caused by it. And then you try and look to see, has that particular vaccine helped people? And time and time and time again, you find that not only has the vaccine not helped people, but the vaccine has actually caused a massive amount of illness. The drug companies just make a vaccine, sell it until they actually get stopped. And it takes quite a long time for that to happen because, of course, doctors who might find that there was something wrong with a vaccine, they'll usually find that their research has been quietly lost.
Well, you're lucky that you didn't end up like Brandy Vaughan. She was working for Merck and blew the whistle about one of their I think she was a particular vaccine that they had, and then she was murdered. So you have to count yourself lucky, Vernon.
Well, our car had the two front tyres, the inner part of the two front tyres were cut down so that the car the two tyres would collapse. It was found by the garage, because routinely it went in for a service, and they found that the tyres had been cut very professionally. So they've tried. We try and protect ourselves as much as possible, because they've done everything to shut me up. And of course, the only real way to provide any protection is to keep talking and keep exposing the...
Well, that's funny, because I thought you were going to say to keep silent.
You thought what, sorry?
I thought you were going to say the only way to keep them away is to keep silent.
Well, that's one way. The other way is keep talking.
Well, I think the other thing is, if you keep silent, then they wait for a while and then they'll have you.
Well, that's probably true. Anyway, keeping silent isn't an option, because I'm very cross about the way medicine has been destroyed. The medical profession has been taken over, lost all its... I loved medicine and doctoring and so on, but all that has been destroyed, utterly, utterly destroyed. You get doctors now who refuse to see patients. As I said, they just hide behind the telephone. The elderly patients just never get seen. People just die without ever being properly treated. Medicine fell apart, really, when doctors stopped doing house calls and when they stopped doing night calls, because there was actually something enormously satisfying.
Yeah. Well, I would say the same about broadcasting. You know, that actually the same kind of thing happened around about the early 1990s. You know, it used to be great fun. All of a sudden you found people who you most respected. I mean, I can remember a beautiful guy that used to come into the BBC to do, he would do a kind of nature talk once a month. It was the best thing on all week on our little local radio station, Wiltshire Sound, based in... he used to come into Salisbury, but it was in Swindon. And you would get a fantastic, like, just that month's... loads of stuff about that month's nature, whether it's flora, fauna, things he'd noticed, someone that knew the countryside back to front. And then suddenly it was, oh, we don't want him anymore. We're getting rid of him. They don't like freelancers. They just want staff people. And, of course, all the staff people they were bringing in were youngsters who had absolutely not a clue. So it was, to me, that was the time, I don't know what it was in medicine, that I actually witnessed broadcasting turn for something which was benefiting the listener to something which was rather sinister, actually. The idea was that someone somewhere was pulling all the strings and only certain views were going to be heard.
Exactly, that's exactly what's happened. It's happened in education, it's happened in the law, it's happened in all the professions, it's happened everywhere. And it's for me, I've spent all my life, I mean, I've sat in two chairs. I've been a doctor, but I've also been in the media for a long time. And I've seen the days when a columnist, I was a columnist for quite a few national newspapers, and I was given total freedom for quite a long time. If I wanted to say something, I was allowed to say it. But in more recent years, that freedom slowly disappeared, and everybody, editors and publishers and whatever, became more and more concerned with making sure that what they did didn't upset the government or whoever else was pulling the strings. And to go back to the COVID thing, the newspapers were totally and utterly bent. Like, the BBC was totally and utterly bent, and the whole of the media, the mainstream media, and much, it has to be said, of the so-called alternative media on the internet was bent, because they were just doing what they were told to do. Huge amounts of in advertising. You remember the Nationals during the COVID hoax, the Nationals were full of full-page adverts with pictures of little doctors on saying, oh, well, you must go and off and get your jab to save the world. There was never any question, never any question in any of them. Is this a good thing that we're doing? Is this necessary? Are the lockdowns really useful? Are any of these things right? In the old days, what you and I would call the good days of broadcasting and newspapers and so on, there would have been both points of view would have been put in a newspaper. You'd have one page which said, yes, lockdowns are great, and on the other page you'd have of people saying no lockdowns are bad.
Well, what worries me is that we haven't seen in many articles recently saying how we've got to make peace with Russia and we shouldn't have a war with them. I mean, you would have thought that that was an obvious one side of a certain discussion. And I don't think there's many, many people out there who would like to sign up to join the army to fight the Russians. I don't think you find anybody unless they're absolutely desperate. And even then, it's pretty unlikely. Now, look, I just want to ask you, so I've got a clip here of you, Vernon. It's a bit cruel of me to do this, with bounce this onto you. But this is you back in 1981. I think, what, how many years ago is that? 46 years ago or so? Maybe not quite so many, 40 years ago. Anyway, roughly over, it's over, what's it, 44 years ago. And we're just going to hear from a young Vernon Coleman, who was a doctor. Were you in Hampshire or somewhere like that?
I was in Warwickshire.
Warwickshire, okay. Well, anyway, it was the local ITV interviewed you about a certain topic, and that was the idea that the DSS were going to be able to have a look at people's medical records to see if they really were sick back in 1981. So let's have a listen to that now. It's just about a minute or so long.
If you're pregnant or you've got venereal disease or you've got asthma or you're depressed or you're suffering from anxiety, I think all these things and a lot of other things are problems which people would very much like to keep between themselves and their doctor. Being from depression, for example, and you work for a large company, you may find that your future role in that company is diminished because the bosses may feel that you're not suitable for promotion. So a simple word on a sick note can ruin a man's career. I think at the moment I'm still bending it. I'm prepared to break it, but I'm still bending it at the moment.
Wouldn't it be simpler for you just to bow to the rules?
Well, there are lots of simpler ways of dealing with it, of course. I could just simply be slightly dishonest and write flu on all the sick notes. But it seems like a slightly easy way out.
Now, you say you're prepared to break the rules. This could cost you £1,000 fine or even more. So how far are you prepared to go?
Yes, well, I suppose eventually they could stop me practising within the health service. But I feel this is so important that it's a basic principle of medical practice, that confidentiality between patient and doctor is of vital importance. And the rules and regulations of the DHSS must come second to that. And if the rules say that I can't maintain confidentiality, then the rules will have to go, or I'll have to go.
Well, that's quite brave of you to say that, Vernon, that either the rules will have to go or I'll have to go.
Yeah, well, I went. they fined me and fined me and fined me, and I refused to... Gosh, I'd forgotten all about all that.
Well, maybe you could just tell us what was going on with that then, because I was guessing that that's what the government were trying to do, was to try to break this confidentiality between patient and doctor.
Well, they broke it because the General Medical Council eventually decided that the Hippocratic Oath was outdated and they didn't really need to bother with it, and confidentiality wasn't the flavour of the month. I scribbled on the sick notes. I had patients who came in and said, look, you have to put what's wrong with me on my sick note, because if you do, I remember I had a patient come in and he was depressed, and he said, if you write depressed on that sick note, they'll fire me. Things was different in those days. And I had a woman who came in and said, if you put pregnant on there, they'll fire me, and so on and so on. And I thought, this isn't right. Why should doctors ever...
Oh, I see. So the people would have to then take those notes into work and show them to their bosses.
Yeah, yeah. They did actually change the rules a little bit in the end, but not quick enough for me. But there you go. I steadfastly refused. And I remember going to some tribunal, and they had a huge pile of these sick notes, and the committee said, we can't read any of the diagnoses that you put on. And they were all just squiggles. And I said, I apologise for my handwriting, gave them to me, and said, well, they said, well, can you tell us what these are? And I said, I think they're all flu.
So this is when the doctor was on the side of the patient, batting for the patient. Wouldn't it be nice if we had a few journalists who were batting for the viewers and batting for the listeners too? Anyway, Vernon, look, what do you put this down to? You're obviously someone who's thinks a bit outside the box and is certainly not afraid of going outside what the establishment are trying to nudge you towards. What do you put this trait in your character down to?
Bloody-mindedness, I suppose. I know, I've never found it easy to accept authority unless what the authority was doing and saying made sense or seemed right. And I've always believed in the freedom of individuals, the real freedom of individuals, to be able to say and do what they want. If people want to say that everyone should have a vaccine and everybody wants to have a vaccine, then so be it. I'll try and argue against them, but I'm not going to stop people doing things. And I get very upset when people try and stop me saying things or stop me doing things just because they're frightened that I might manage to influence people by saying something or by producing some evidence. And I've always tried to produce evidence since I've been tried to produce evidence which proves my point. And for example, going back to the wretched COVID, in 2020, before the vaccines were rolled out, I found and produced evidence that was taken down very quickly that the vaccines would cause a whole range of neurological problems. They would cause heart problems. They would cause blood clotting. They would cause strokes. And so on and so on and so on. And all that happened was there was never any debate about this, which there should have been, of course. All that happened was that the videos were taken down, and I was jeered at and suppressed and subjected to a whole range of indignities.
One thing that you've said is this thing about sort of reducing population. I don't know if that's eugenics, population reduction, the idea that someone out there would rather reduce the world's population. I know King Charles has said this in the past, that we need three worlds in order to actually support the number of people that are on planet Earth right now. So that obviously implies that we need to kill 2/3 of the world's population. Do you think this is credible, and if so, why?
It's not a credible argument at all. There's plenty of food on the planet. Most of it's in the wrong place.
But what about the are there people out there that want to kill millions or even billions of people?
There are huge numbers of very powerful people who believe that the world is massively overpopulated. You look at some of the stuff that the World Economic Forum, Bill Gates, you look at what these people have said, and the idea of getting rid of what they call useless eaters, which takes us back to euthanasia, of course, because in countries where they've already got euthanasia or doctor-assisted suicide or whatever you want to call it, in countries like that, what's happening is that people are being allowed or encouraged to kill themselves if they don't have a job or if they're disabled or in some way because they're considered to be, quote, useless eaters, quote. And that's a phrase which has been bandied around amongst the very powerful people who do believe that there's too many people. There's no evidence that there's too many people. One of the problems, of course, is that the oil's running out and the very rich and powerful want more of it for themselves and less of it for other people. It's not a question of food. There's plenty of food around. There's plenty of land around. It's not a question of any of that. It's just simply a question of control, which is not something I think is right. I don't think people should... one of the arguments during the euthanasia debate was that people who feel that they're a burden should be allowed to kill themselves. Actually, they wouldn't kill themselves. Somebody would do it for them because they wouldn't be able to do it themselves because of the technology and so on. But, I mean, what sort of world are we in when people are saying, if you feel worthless... I'll tell you something else about euthanasia. You know, most 9 out of 10 of people who try to commit suicide, which is what this form of euthanasia is being sold as, They say afterwards, it was a terrible mistake. I didn't want to do it, really, and now I'm glad I didn't, because my life's turned around.
Oh, you know, that's such an important point to make, isn't it? I've spoken to several, you know, in my lifetime, several people who were so pleased that a suicide attempt wasn't successful. Amazing, you're absolutely right. And that hasn't really been touched on at all. So, anyway, your latest book is called The End of Medicine, Vernon. I wondered, I mean, it's about this whole business of global warming and its effect. But what about, I mean, some of your, I think what, if someone is coming to you maybe for the first time and wanting some advice, I can remember years ago seeing a book of yours in the bookshop upstairs from my office. It was called How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. And I think, in a way, it's the best title of any of the books you've ever written, because that's what people want to know. They know there's an absolute minefield out there. There's some really good doctors out there, like Dr. Mercola in the United States. The people at Children's Health Defence seem to be doing a very, very good job. But you really do need to know how to stop your doctor killing you. How, when a doctor advises you to go through a procedure, take a drug, maybe have an operation, you need to know, is this for my own good, or is this feathering the nest of some drug company? You need to know the answer to that question now. So I wonder, you know, what books would you recommend of your own that help people make those decisions?
How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You is still around, new version, because when that book first came out, I went, I remember going to Portugal. I had my agent there took me and just a book cover with the title on it to a publisher in Portugal, and he saw the book cover with the title on, and I jumped up and down. I said, I'll buy this now. I want the book. How quickly can you write the book? Because he thought it was a snappy title too. The answer is to be aware, and How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You is probably the book that answers the questions of exactly what sort of things you need to know from your doctor. And I it's a long time since I looked at it, but I did look at it, but it's up to date. But it's a long time since I wrote.
And what about those that question I asked my doctor about ivermectin? Have you got any other good questions that you can ask your GP? Just sort of drop it into the conversation. So you get an indication of where they're coming from in terms of the profession.
Here's a good one. Are there any side effects with vaccine? If he says, no, there are no side effects with vaccines, get out of the chair, however poor you feel, and run like stink, because he's a lunatic. No, I'm serious. You obviously mustn't get up and run out of
the... I mean, another thing is, just in the news this week, is this whole idea of chemically castrating people instead of keeping them in prison.
Yeah, well, the problem with doing things like that is that if you make a mistake, as the judicial system seems to be doing with monotonous regularity, if you send somebody for prison for 40 years by mistake, you can at least attempt to make some sort of reparation. But if you chemically castrate them, that's pretty final, isn't it? It's a sort of light version of hanging them. I'm not wild about doctors being involved in any sort of punishment regime, because doctors' job is to look after people, not to kill them or maim them. It's to try to diagnose people and then to try to cure them. And when I gave up being a GP, which I didn't have a lot of choice over, because of the business with the confidentiality of the sick notes, where I refused to kowtow, and I became basically a book writer, although I did a lot of broadcasting, but I became a book writer. I decided that I, instead of treating patients retail, I'd treat patients wholesale and try to explain to people how they could best look for ways to treat themselves and ways to make sure that they got a good deal out of their doctor. Actually, The End of Medicine also, I tried to include advice on how people could try to protect themselves and look after themselves. And there's actually a very good book, which I didn't write, about, I can't remember the title of it. Hang on, I've got my book there. It's actually, it's a book for people, captains on ships, when obviously you have an emergency and there isn't a doctor around. It's called The Ship Captain's Medical Guide.
Right.
And it's brilliant. I bought one, I was looking at it, and I was terribly impressed, because whatever it is, it's got advice, because don't forget, if you're on a ship and you haven't got a doctor, which most commercial ships obviously don't, the captain's responsible, and he's got to know what to do.
Yeah.
The government produces it, or some government department. You have to hold your nose a bit about that. But I found it amazingly good information, because that's all it is. It's just information. What do you do in an emergency when there isn't a doctor around? And a lot of the time, that's what people are going to have to do now, because there'll be lots of emergencies and not a lot of doctors around.
And also not a lot of trustworthy. This is, seems to me, the problem, because, I mean, it's almost as if some of the Dr. Mengele characters have been allowed to run riot, certainly in the last 5 or 6 years. And, I mean, we did look in... I mean, I personally got COVID back in 2019, before it was kind of supposed to exist. At least I had all the symptoms of the official COVID, where you can't smell and all these kind of things. It was a really very nasty flu anyway. I wonder what you make. I'm going to play a clip now, Vernon. I hope you don't mind hanging on. It's only about a minute or so long, but it's from an RT, Russia Today piece recently, which looked at, I mean, Mengele and the Nazis are quite well known, but apparently the Japanese were up to this too. And it's almost as if these people have now kind of come back after 80 or so years since World War II, when we thought we'd got rid of them all. They're back again. Anyway, it'd be interesting to get your comment after we've heard this.
In 1932, microbiologist and Lieutenant General Shiro Ishii led Japan's first biological weapons program, which expanded in 1936 into a massive facility in Pingfang. The complex, staffed by thousands and equipped with labs, operating rooms, barracks and cremation sites, became the heart of the Unit 731. From 1933 to 1945, the unit carried out gruesome human experiments to explore the defensive and offensive potential of pathogens like typhoid, cholera, anthrax, tetanus, and the plague. Cruel medical experiments, vivisections, exposure to freezing conditions, suffocation, as well as deadly diseases were inflicted on prisoners of war, primarily Chinese and Russian, along with some Mongolians and Koreans. These atrocities claimed lives of over 3,000 defenseless victims. According to the unit members, the true number of victims could be much higher. Here's how one participant described one of the unit's so-called experiments.
Well, we'll leave it there. But Vernon, what do you make of this? I mean, some might call me a conspiracy theorist for even bringing it up, but it does seem as if, particularly with the COVID jabs, that was a massive human experiment. And this is totally banned in any kind of moral and ethical world.
Experiments carried on all the time now with, as I was explaining in the end of medicine, the changes which they're making, new products, the old products that are well tried and useful, the changes that they're making, reduction in the number of antibiotics and so on, these have not been tested and tried. They've just leapt on these new ideas. And we're now in the situation. I think the most of the doctors in what I call the medical establishment, which is, of course, the medical establishment, most of the doctors who are running the medical establishment are just as guilty as Mengele. They're condoning experimental procedures. They're not questioning what's happening. They're not looking at the reasons why things happen. They're not assessing. Doctors have now officially diagnosed 9 million people in Britain with autism. you think maybe it might be a chance, time to actually look at whether this is right and whether there might be a cause? Could it be anything to do with vaccines?
Yeah, maybe Andrew Wakefield was right, and this was directly linked to it.
I put money betting that he was right and the medical establishment was wrong, because most of the time the medical establishment is wrong. If you look historically at the number of... When Semmelweis first found the link between purple fever and the fact that medical students weren't washing their hands after they'd been in the mortuary, he was laughed at. Everything in medicine that's been developed and been introduced before... Joseph Lister, surgeons used to sharpen their knife on the soles of their boots, never change their clothes, never wash their hands, and 99% of people who went to the operating theatre died. And then Lister started trying to take care to be a bit cleaner and so on, and sprayed carbolic in the atmosphere in the operating theatre, and the number of people dying fell by 90%. The medical establishment obviously opposed it viciously. And so this is, you have to remember that doctors promoted smoking as a good way to clear people's chests. The medical establishment, by and large, has always got everything wrong.
Well, look, before we just ask you about where people can get hold of the book, Vernon, it is so lovely that you were promoting some other book rather than your own book when I asked you about that, what people can read. But what about the other side of things where, I do find that quite often I would much rather a doctor said something about actually, you know, change your diet, use this in your diet, and how can we look after our bodies without using drugs or the medical system in terms of what we eat, and particularly look after our own immune system?
The immune systems need vitamin D. During the lockdowns, I made one of the many videos I made, which was deleted very quickly, suggested that because of the fact that people weren't getting any sunshine, they should take extra vitamin D or take vitamin D supplements, make sure that their immune systems were carefully protected in that way. That video was taken down in minutes, inevitably, and yet that's good, solid, protective medicine. There's an awful lot of talk about the fat jabs protecting people because they have an anti-inflammatory effect. If you look at the list of side effects, which I've put in the end of medicine, you wouldn't want to touch any of them with a barge pole, I must confess. But there is actually a drug which is rather cheaper, which has a good anti-inflammatory effect. And quite a lot of doctors who now recommend taking a 75 milligram aspirin tablet, particularly if you have cancer or if you're over 75, over 50, is aspirin, because it has a very powerful anti-inflammatory effect. But of course, drug companies never recommend aspirin. Medical journalists never recommend aspirin because it's cheap. And where's the profit in recommending that? Where's the profit in recommending diets? Where's the profit in telling people they eat too much fat and telling people not to eat fatty meat and so on and so on? There's very little useful preventive medicine out there because there's not a lot of profit in it. There's not a lot of money to be made out of telling people how to change their lifestyle in order to improve their health and their longevity. But there's a hell of a lot of profit to be made out of jabbing everyone with a whole pile of vaccines which have probably never been properly tested and which have certainly never been tested.
And also the sort of getting people who have got some sort of potentially chronic illness to get stuck into being chronic in that illness and then having a regular drug to feed them. Anyway, look, so whereabouts, I mean, I don't know if you're doing any book signings or that sort of thing, but if people are interested in getting your latest, The End of Medicine with all these things in, or any of your other books, where's the best place to go?
Through the bookshop on my website, www.vernoncoleman.com. That there's a bookshop there, but there's the website's all entirely free. There's no adverts. There's no sponsorship. It's just piles and piles and piles of articles telling people my view on whatever the latest nonsense is, or how to stay fit and healthy and avoid all the problems which are multiplying around us all the time.
Okay. Okay, Dr. Vernon Coleman, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tony.
Boris Johnson reading the Parable of the Good Samaritan. Next, the great Welsh hymn tune, St. Denio. Immortal, invisible, God only wise.
Victorious, thy God.
and drink the milk of paradise.
Bella!
So that's from 1977. The album is called Farewell to Kings, by the Canadian rock band Rush, who have their moments, and that's one of them. Even though, actually, of course, it's Samuel Taylor Coleridge's moment, really. The poem, he is Kubla Khan, and he was interrupted. He was in some sort of opium reverie, morphine reverie. Actually, it wasn't morphine, was it, that he used to take, Martin? What was it?
It was laudanum, which is opium with, in, you water. Know, some... With
a tincture alcohol. Alcohol, yeah. So that was the stuff, and he was interrupted in the middle of the poem, so it never got finished. But he did very well up until he did get interrupted. So that's Rush, as I say, from 1977. Before that, we had Immortal Invisible, Choir of King's College, Cambridge. Just another one of those wonderful hymns we don't seem to hear enough about, or enough of, these days. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The romantic movement, which Coleridge was part of, wasn't that supposed to be, before we get stuck into the news, but wasn't it supposed to be a reaction against the sort of mechanistic Enlightenment? And, well, I mean, maybe you can just put
obviously, yes, because it, classical Enlightened thinking, you know, basically privileged, you know, the rational mind, as opposed to superstition and so on, whereas the Romantics, you know, were focused on feelings and emotions and all that sort of stuff. And of course, it still dominates. The Romantic sensibility still dominates our culture.
A reaction against the dark satanic mills, that sort of thing.
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, but of course, you know, there was all sorts of different ways in which that was manifested.
Go on.
Well, all sorts of different art forms and people, you know.
So poetry, there was obviously
painting, all this sort
William
of stuff.
Morris and the the architecture, design, drawing.
Yeah. And it still obviously dominates
things like pre-Raphaelite art.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about, you know, the whole emphasis in our culture on finding yourself when you're a young person and going travelling and all this stuff, that's very much romantic product.
Well, it's actually very practical too, isn't it? I mean, it's quite useful to see and to do, yeah. So, you know, it's all right if you've got the money to do it. And, of course, usually it's the more privileged and wealthy that can afford to just go zipping around the world when they reach the age of, well, I mean, I did it when I was in my 20s. I had a 3 months over in South America, which was fantastic. Really, really wouldn't miss that for the world. Brilliant. Fascinating. Before we get into the Gaza news, I just think there was another clip from the interview I did with Steve Hall, who I cannot recommend enough. Vernon Coleman should be the Secretary of State for Health, which he would be in my dream team. Then Steve Hall would be Chancellor of the Exchequer. Sorry, Martin, not you. I just think he's a little, you know, maybe you could be Chief Secretary. You could have Darren Jones.
I want defence.
Oh, I don't know who would be doing defence, but anyway, look, I mean, okay. But anyway, let's have another listen to Steve Hall, because he talks here quite a bit about the captured government. He reckons the City of London has been completely in control for centuries.
The issue here is that the government is a sovereign currency issue, and it has as much money as it needs, up to the point of inflation. And even inflation is determined by price rises. So the government...
But hang on, the Bank of England has been printing money, hasn't it, Steve? I thought ever since 2008.
Yeah, but it's been going into the reserve accounts of the banks. So it hasn't been used for public purpose. It was used to bail out the banks.
Hang on, you're reminding me. I think it was John McDonnell talked about the quantitative easing for the people.
Well, it's quantitative easing. It was a term invented by Richard Werner, the economist, the German-British economist. And it was basically to bail out the banks. So that money hasn't been used for public purpose. It's simply disappeared into the bank's reserve account.
So you're saying that's a choice? That's a choice they've made?
Everything's a political choice. Now, as I say, the state's a sovereign currency, so you can choose what it wants to do with the money. But, of course, don't forget, a lot of this sovereign currency is issued by private bank loans. Private banks don't issue their customers' savings. They keep them for clearance, settlement, and interbank lending. What they do is that they create new money every time they make a loan, so they're actually increasing the money supply. At the moment, it's around about, don't quote me on this because I haven't looked at the figures recently, but it's about 40% of the money is issued by the state free, and 60%, somewhere 55-60% is issued by private banks for interest, as interest-bearing loans. Now, who do you think the private banks want to be in charge of creating new money? If they, issued for interest payments, you know, and the state can issue it free. And it's obvious, isn't it? The private banking industry wants to be in charge of issuing currency. So it wants to reduce the amount of money. So when they go on about big government and Doge and all of this, what they're doing is they're simply trying to take away as much of the state's ability to issue currency as possible, and to issue it themselves as private loans, for which they charge compound interest, and that's their business. And as they've been in their business for a long time, I mean, you read the economist Michael Hudson, probably the best on this. He traces this struggle back 4,500 years. Private landowners issuing their own currency. And the state, the palace economies, the old Bronze Age palace economies, of course, could issue their currency free. There's an argument of Julius Caesar with his landowning class. It goes back so long, this struggle. It underpins the class struggle. It undercuts the class struggle.
Am I right in thinking that it was also involved in the US War of Independence, that the Americans were fed up with having their money system controlled by the Brits?
Yes, and Ben Franklin introduced colonial scrip, which was their own currency, and they issued it freely. And not only, it's a pity they had to spend it on war, because they also used it for everyday transactions, and American economy boomed under Ben Franklin's colonial scrip. As soon as Franklin was out of power, and others came in, then the bankers homed in on this, and they started to issue their own private currency. And of course, with the political relationships, they put in politicians who agree with them. And of course, the media's on their side as well. Now, the next person to issue sovereign currency was, of course, Abraham Lincoln, the greenbacks for the Civil War. Again, pretty it's used for war, but it can be used for any public purpose. And you know what happened to him, don't you?
Well, what happened to Lincoln was that he was assassinated, and it's presumed by some that he was assassinated precisely because he was intending to manage the peacetime economy in the US at the end of the Civil War by issuing greenbacks. In other words, not allowing, you know, not borrowing the money from Wall Street or from whoever. And of course, what happened after he died is they went back to borrowing from the private banking system.
He said something I thought fascinating. I mean, I love Steve's stuff, but as far as I'm concerned, he's Britain's Michael Hudson. He's done a fantastic job, I think, in pulling all these things apart from a particularly a British perspective. It depends if you think Wall Street or the city is in charge. As we heard last week from Phil Bevan, I think he's saying he thinks the city is still in charge, but he's saying that this struggle undercuts and underpins the whole class struggle. Was that something Marx would agree with, do you think?
Well, what's in reference to?
In this, who's going to print the money? The idea of public money or borrowing banks?
I would argue that one of the problems with people who are interested in these topics is that they just presume that there's a kind of technical fix, that modern monetary theory means that you could just print the money, and of course you could, and that all we need to do is just, you know, it's just stupidity, why don't we do it? Well, we don't do it because the wealthy classes won't let us do it,
classes, it's the class struggle.
It's
really
a class struggle ultimately, because that is the policy.
Did Marx really understand this fully, do you think?
Yes, I mean, Michael Hudson's pretty good on all this. And he's pointing out that people only ever read volume one of Capital, if they bother to read it at all. But most of the important stuff is in volumes two and three, which is all about the circulation of credit.
He never
managed to finish his great work because there was just too much.
But he was good. He was very good. Engels and Marx were writing fantastic stuff. Like what they were doing essentially was, and a lot of people go, "Oh, you can't be a Marxist, you're a Satanist." You know, people do actually think that and say it, and unbelievably, Marx, of course, communism was a sort of satanic version of Christianity, because the idea is it's a lot of Christian values in communism in terms of redistributing wealth, do unto others, you know, etc. But the idea is that you mustn't have any religion. You're not allowed to have religion. Am I getting Marx right or wrong?
Well,
he was just very, very good at pulling apart.
Let me put it this way. Yeah. Let me put it this way. The original conception of Marx and Engels was that capitalism was a necessary stage of human development. Now, when communism came to power in Russia and China, even the people who'd seized power in both of those countries realised that they hadn't got a modern capitalist economy. So a lot of the distortions in what happened in Russia and China is because he hadn't actually got a modern capitalist economy.
They'd taken God out of the equation. They'd knocked down the cathedral in Moscow and all this sort of thing. So they missed a whole dimension to life.
Okay. But I mean, I'm trying to just focus on the economics for the minute. And of course, Plekhanov, who was the father of Russian Marxism, he made the case that what Russia needs to do is have a democratic capitalist society, which will then evolve into socialism, because that was the original conception. You can't really have socialism in a poverty-stricken society without low levels of education and productivity. The purpose of capitalism is it educates the workforce, it gives them technical skills, and then, of course, you can then transcend capitalism, move to socialism, and then ultimately to communism, which is a bit of a fantasy. But the whole point is that you go capitalism first, socialism next. Now, China at the moment has got a very successful capitalist economy, but they're moving towards socialism. I think some of the Chinese economists would say, well, we haven't got socialism yet, we're working towards it. And that is, in fact, real world.
Maybe there's some people in China that don't want that.
There's a billionaire class in China who would like, if they got the chance, they would like, Jack Ma.
Marx would turn in his grave.
No, he wouldn't, because he'd be
a billionaire communist.
You're just, the point about Marxism is it's quite a sophisticated philosophy. It doesn't just say, why don't we just share everything?
So it's okay to have billionaire communists. Yeah,
no, you start off having, Jack Ma is a billionaire in China. And what he tried to do a few years ago, he tried to set up a fintech company, supposedly a tech company, which was basically a bank that people would be able to access it on their phones and so on. So what the communist Chinese authorities did, they stopped him from doing it. You can't do that because of very strict regulations about setting up banks in China. And then he disappeared for several months and everybody thought, what's happened to him? And then he came out of hiding in the poorest village in China saying, I'm really sorry. I want to apologize to the Chinese people about this. I was trying to make the money without doing the work. And I accept my punishment. And of course,
so the other billionaires have done the work.
Yeah, well, the point is that the billionaire in China is publicly humiliated by the communist government.
Or one of them, anyway.
Yeah, the billionaires in the United States run the government, and that's the big difference.
Maybe, yeah. One of the reasons I thought I'd talk about this before we get to talk about Gaza in a minute, which we will do, don't worry, is this whole idea of socialism being such a threat. And Steve is talking about that there, explaining how the money system is designed to prevent socialism. It's also designed to force people into poverty so they can't have a decent life, they can't be politically active, all this sort of thing. And it undercuts, as you said, the class struggle. But this is amazing. So I was interviewing Chris Nicholson this week. He's a former judge and lawyer in South Africa. He's just come out with a book about the murder of Chris Hani, who was an ANC activist over there. But it comes up in his book, Martin. It's all the way through. The various people who were being assassinated in South Africa, including Chris Hani, they were all trying to redistribute wealth. And it wasn't just in South Africa, Namibia and other countries too. So it was this was a very deliberate, it seems, post-colonial policy is to allow Africans independence, but to kill off anyone who was socialist.
That's right. Chris Hani was a Communist Party of South Africa guy, and he was very popular, and he would have been in line to take over from Mandela if he hadn't been assassinated. And of course, what you, this row we've been having this week between Ramaphosa and Trump.
Yeah.
What was agreed is that you can have a black majority rule in South Africa, but you can't touch the land or the wealth. Right. The wealth and the land. 73% of the best land in South Africa is owned by 7% of the population, the white population.
Well, we have got a clip on that in a minute, but don't jump ahead. We're just going to hear, first of all, from Chris Nicholson. He's got a new book out about the murder of Chris Hani over in South Africa, as you quite rightly said, was set to be the successor to Nelson Mandela. But the interesting connection I found, I didn't know anything about this at all, is he believes that this was one of the reasons for the Lockerbie bombing.
Well, you know, the finger of suspicion points to South African agents. And, you know, one of the, I don't know if you call it these hangars or wherever the baggage was kept at Heathrow, you know, warehouses, the padlock was cut on that night, you know, so this bag with the bomb, and I think it was, as you suggest, an altitude bomb at a certain altitude, it goes off. So, you know, I found a lot of evidence that shows a different, you know, scenario for the Lockerbie bomb blast and the crash. So, and if this man Bernd Carlson was the real target, then it explains why the cases he was bringing against the corporations suddenly disappeared, you know. So whatever getting him out of the way as a target and a victim was very successful, because those cases were then dropped immediately. So it's a fascinating part of the book on its own.
Now, you mentioned various other individuals who, if I can just run through them, you mentioned some other individuals that you connect. So you've talked about Patrice Lumumba in 1961. You talked about Dag Hammarskjöld, the United Nations Secretary General, who was trying to stop armed insurrections in Africa, and that was in 1961 too. And Olof Palme, you mentioned him. Bernd Carlson. That's the guy we've just talked about. And what about this other chap, Anton Lebowski?
Lebowski. Now, he was a white advocate in Southwest Africa, or Namibia, as it became, and he joined SWAPO, which was the black, organization there, fighting, the white apartheid forces in Namibia, and he was hated, and he was similar to Chris Hani. He's almost his political twin. He was trying to...
Sorry, he said...
Diamonds and all the...
He sounds like a hero. He sounds like a hero to me, but you say he was hated.
Yes, but he was hated by the whites, but he was a hero to the Vembos, to the Africans. And he was writing, and he was trying to, again, redistribute the wealth of Namibia, because it was being plundered by the corporates in that country. They were taking it out hand over fist, to the diamonds and uranium, etc., etc. So he was now advising Sam Nujoma, who was going to become the first president of Namibia, and he was advising him that there should be a redistribution of the wealth in Namibia. It should be shared amongst the population, because Namibia has got a relatively small population, probably then less than 3 million. So there was plenty of minerals and resources to go around, and yet, you know, these countries like South Africa and Namibia and them have the worst Gini coefficient in the world. You know, that's the gap between rich and poor. So what these people were trying to do was remedy that Gini coefficient, that gap between the rich and the poor. So they were then taken out to stop them doing that. And Anton Lebowski, he was gunned down outside his house in the same way that Chris Hani was, I think on the 12th of September 1989. You know, the Lockerbie was the 21st of December, 1988, you know, the midwinter 1988. And this Lebowski guy was trying to do the same thing. He was trying to redistribute the wealth. He'd written a lot about it. He was detained a lot. He was an incredibly brave man. And so they just gunned him down. And Tony, something I must mention is that it seems to me that part of the African elite were joining forces with the colonialists and the corporates, because they had been bought and they were going to be the new leaders in the country and not try and go for a redistribution of the wealth.
Well, that's right. I mean, the deal done by Mandela and the ANC negotiators was, if you allow us to come to power through a democratic election, the quid pro quo is that we won't carry through the radical policies that the ANC, under the guidance of the Communist Party of South Africa, wanted to pursue. So instead of Hani taking over after Mandela, we had Mbeki. And of course, the whole thing was an American-style thing, where as long as you empower some black people, then we'll keep the basic structure of the economy in South Africa the same, but we'll have some black faces in all the corporations. And of course, that suited the Americans, the British, the outside forces. So the more radical demands of the ANC were sidelined. And if you look politically at where South Africa is today, the ANC lost its majority at the last election, not because the right-wing Democratic Party had come forward. They're the sort of, they're the white party plus hangers-on. It was because the ANC's left wing split off. Jacob Zuma and Malema, who is, was being quoted by Trump, they want to go back to redistributing wealth. And ultimately, of course, this is what's going to have to happen in this country.
That means land.
Yes, it certainly does. And of course, ultimately, countries like Brazil and South Africa are so miserably poor because they haven't redistributed wealth. China has.
And that's why they're wealthier. Let me just say, land is the origin of all wealth.
Well, it's not the only thing. It's very important.
The origin of all wealth. So if you want to make some wealth, then you've got to dig something out of the land and you've got to do something with it. And you've got to have a workshop to do it, which is on the land. And if you haven't got any land, then you don't really have any access to wealth. So landlessness is a massive problem. It always has been in these colonial countries.
Well, what happened when the Boer trekkers ended up in what is now the Orange Free State and the Transvaal? They took over all the best land, and it was already being farmed by the locals, and then they turned the locals into a captive workforce for themselves.
Well, it's exactly the same in Ireland, isn't it?
Yeah,
all the best land in Northern Ireland was all given to the Protestant settlers in the Cromwell's time around that era,
and the
Catholics were pushed all out to the marginal
land. The same thing is happening in Palestine, where people from outside have come in, and the difference in Palestine is they don't want to exploit the locals, they want to exterminate them like the Sioux or the Apache.
Well, sometimes I love you, Martin, for bringing Palestine in just at the right moment, because I wonder, in fact, surely this business of Trump, we're going to hear a clip from at the moment this week, along with the South African President Ramaphosa in the Oval Office, where he's basically ambushed him with some video and audio clips that he wasn't expecting. This has got to be related to the whole Gaza business and the fact that the South Africans are the lead country in challenging the Israelis at the International Criminal Court, or am I just...
No, you are right, but it's also, don't forget, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel are white South Africans, and they're the ones who bent Donald Trump's mind on this one as well. You know, we're being persecuted here. 47 white South Africans have been allowed to flee to the United States, being given immediate...
He's called it a genocide.
Well, yes, what's happened, he was saying when he was holding up these pictures of these white farmers who've been killed, executed. They've not been executed, they've been robbed and killed. And as various people, as Ramaphosa pointed out, we've got a very big problem with violent crime in South Africa. Yeah. But the people who suffer the most from this are poor black people.
Yeah, and who started it? Cecil Rhodes, matey. Anyway, let's have a listen now to this exchange at the White House earlier this week with Ramaphosa and Trump.
Mr. President, what would it take for you to be convinced that there's no white genocide in South Africa?
Well, I can answer that for the President.
President will respond to you.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. President.
It will take President Trump listening to the voices of South Africans, some of whom are his good friends, like those who are here when we have talks between us on the quiet, at a quiet table, it will take President Trump to listen to them. I'm not going to be repeating what I've been saying. I would say if there was Afrikaner farmer genocide, I can bet you these three gentlemen would not be here, including my Minister of Agriculture. He would not be with me. So it will take him, President Trump, listening to their stories, to their perspective. That is the answer to your question.
But, Mr. President, I must
President
say that
Trump.
We have... No, no, wait. We have thousands of stories talking about it.
Sure.
And we have documentaries, we have news stories. And that, is Natalie here, somebody here to turn that? I could show you a couple of things, and I would... I have to... It has to be responded to.
Yeah, sure. We will.
Let me see the articles, please, if you would. And turn, excuse me, turn the lights down. Turn the lights down and just put this on. It's right behind you, Johan.
There's nothing this parliament can do. With or without you, people are going to occupy land. We require no permission from you, from the president, from no one.
So that's people occupying white land, Martin, and this apparently is also leading to the deaths of some of the whites in South Africa.
Well, the people that have been dying are being robbed, basically, because they've got 40% unemployment in South Africa, so 40% of the population wakes up every day, and there's no benefits, because if they gave benefits to black people, they'd have to give them to white people, so they have to get up
this
every day and make a living.
This is all about redistribution. It's going right back to the 1980s and the death of Chris Tarney. It's the same problem.
It is. Well, I mean, what's happened is that the current leadership in South Africa has got to tread a very fine balance between keeping in with people like the United States and the British and their own white... You know,
it's like they're not being allowed to do the one thing which might calm things down in South Africa if their wealth was redistributed better.
Well, they're not allowed to do it because then they would set a bad example and everybody else would have to do it.
Set a good example.
Well, no, but from the point of view of the wealthy classes at
over
the core
here,
of the system, not want that to happen.
In Wall Street, in the city of London and Frankfurt.
Yeah, I mean, even tiny little countries like Nicaragua.
Is it surprising that the Chinese are doing quite well by going into these countries and saying, hang on, we've got a different way of doing things?
Well, that's the way they're competing. Back in the 70s, they used to supply military advice and weaponry to things like the Zimbabwean African National Liberation Army, which, fought out of Mozambique. The Chinese don't really support insurgency in the third world anymore. What they do is they're going around offering better deals than the West can offer, and that's very attractive.
Infrastructure.
Yeah. I mean, they're not entirely selfless in all of this. They've got their interests involved, but basically they're offering the developing world an alternative model, you know, because the Western style system that's been imposed in South Africa and loads of other places is extractive. All that money, wealth generated in South Africa, ends up in the core of the system, flowing around in the city of London, and that makes, you know, the wealthy core of the economy, global economy, very prosperous for the wealthy few that are prospering. But it's a daily robbery of the poorest people on the planet.
So before we go to Gaza again, I keep putting this off, but let's have a quick look at Andriy Portnov. This is some guy who's been arrested for setting fire to Keir Starmer's various things to do with Keir Starmer.
Well, I was reading an interesting article by Martin Jay on Strategic Culture Foundation website today, who suggests that there may be some gay sex blackmail aspect to this.
Right. Also, is it not possible that if he, because he's Ukrainian, I mean, it might be he's just over here from the Ukrainian secret police to threaten Starmer.
Well, you better
make sure you keep.
Well, I mean, I very much doubt.
Don't take any advice from Trump, or else we're going to kill you.
Well, no, the thing is that Starmer, after Trump and Putin had their phone call this week, Trump then phoned all the other people in Europe to talk to them about what he phoned Maloney and Merz but Starmer wasn't allowed to be in on the phone call because he's regarded as too pro-Ukrainian.
to be, you know, there's no point bothering with it. Starmer.
So do you think Putin is saying you can talk to, you can share this with everybody, but not with the Brits?
It was Trump's decision not to bring Starmer into the conversation.
Right, okay. Interesting.
Because Starmer is regarded as too close to Zelensky, or rather the fact is Zelensky is a
British
puppet.
Trust him, it'll go straight back to Zelensky.
Well, no, I mean, it's just, all of this stuff is signalling, isn't
it? It's not going to be part of the solution.
Yeah.
Trump has decided that Brits are not going to be part of the solution, it's to keep them out of the way.
That's right.
Wow, interesting. So, also we've had these two Israelis shot in the United States. What do you make of that? The two Israelis, to understand the kind of person. Here is one view. Yaron Lishinsk was his final post on X before he was murdered or assassinated. The Israeli diplomat over in Washington brazenly denied the slaughter of 14,000 Palestinian babies and smeared UN warnings as nothing more than blood libel. He didn't just represent the Israeli embassy. He was a mouthpiece for some of its most vicious propaganda. His legacy is stained with cruelty, denial, and the relentless dehumanization of a grieving people. But who did this? Is it feasible? Is it possible that the Israelis might have done this just to up the ante and give Netanyahu an excuse to say what we're going to hear from him in a moment? A big speech against all the Europeans that are helping kill these diplomats by failing to support Israel?
Well, obviously, we don't know enough to be sure what's happened here, apart from the fact that two people are dead. There's already a shooter been apprehended. He seems to have some kind of Latin background, and he's he did apparently shout "Free Palestine" when he did it. Now, it could be that the Israelis have set this up because they do, in fact, carry out false flag attacks on their own people. They do it. They're that cynical and that vicious. On the other hand,
things like the bus attacks in Israel itself, often this is just the Israelis doing.
Yes, I mean, but we shouldn't be jumping to conclusions with the amount of information we've got.
No, true.
On the other hand, I would point out that if these two Israeli diplomats have been killed, the Israelis are the ones who've said it's absolutely okay to kill your political opponents. Nasrallah, they attacked the Iranian embassy in Damascus and killed a load of people. Now, if you're going to go around attacking other people's embassies and killing their embassy staff, well, that makes your embassy staff fair game, doesn't it?
Well, we've seen over the last couple of weeks, we've seen quite a big turn of the news tide against Israel. Do you think that's work or not?
Well, I think what's happening is because of the breakdown of the last ceasefire, where the Israelis had agreed that they would allow humanitarian aid
and the subsequent starvation.
Yes, exactly. But they've now decided they're not interested in having any kind of negotiation, and at that point, you see, Keir Starmer, for example, is suddenly beginning to realise that public opinion in this country is absolutely hostile to what the Israelis are doing, and if he's seen to be supporting it, he will. And the same goes for Farage and Kemi Badenoch, by the way, who were at the...
Well, they seem to be staying out of the way, mostly. They weren't doing that in public, were they? They were doing it in a very sneaky fashion.
Well, that's right.
Going to the Israeli party.
The point is, I think this is going to be quite explosive in British politics, because if these people are allowed to be starved to death in front of us and we do nothing, then people are going to start questioning.
Well, it seems to be almost like it's starting to bring into motion the little bit of democracy we've got left. Anyway, let's have a listen to Netanyahu and his response to the killing of these two Israelis over in Washington this week.
Last night in Washington, something horrific happened. A brutal terrorist shot in cold blood a young, beautiful couple, Yaron Lishinsky and Sarah Milgram. Yaron had just bought an engagement ring for Sarah. He was planning to give it to her in Jerusalem next week. They were planning to start a new and happy life together. Well, that tragically did not happen. Yaron and Sarah weren't the victims of a random crime. The terrorist who cruelly gunned them down did so for one reason and one reason alone. He wanted to kill Jews. And as he was taken away, he chanted, "Free Palestine." This is exactly the same chant we heard on October 7th. On that day, thousands of terrorists stormed into Israel from Gaza. They beheaded men. They raped women. They burned babies alive. They butchered 1,200 innocent people and took 251 innocent people hostage to the dungeons of Gaza. A short time afterwards, Chancellor Scholz of Germany visited Israel. And after he saw the horrors, he said to me, "These Hamas terrorists are exactly like the Nazis." He was right. And if they could get away with it, these Hamas terrorists would have slaughtered every last Jew on earth. For these neo-Nazis, Free Palestine is just today's version of Heil Hitler. They don't want a Palestinian state. They want to destroy the Jewish state. They want to annihilate the Jewish people who've been in the land of Israel for 3,500 years. I could never understand how this simple truth evades the leaders of France, Britain, Canada, and others. They're now proposing to establish a Palestinian state and reward these murderers with the ultimate prize.
So that's the ultimate prize, which is the prize that he and his friends got back in 1948, Martin, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's the hypocrisy of it all is absolutely disgusting, isn't it? The Israeli state was created through violence. They killed Count Bernadotte, who is the UN's mediator. They killed Lord Moyne, who is a British, personal friend of Churchill. They killed loads and loads of Jews who didn't agree with them and what they wanted to do. And they got a state at the end of it. And Hamas, love them or loathe them, all they are doing is copying the tactics of the Likud, the Irgun, and the Lehi. There's no difference.
Well, meanwhile, we have a rather horrific situation of the aid being kept, as we heard from Fatima a couple of weeks ago, over 3,000 truckloads of aid, mostly in terms of food, but also some water, some medical supplies, and other aid. Some of them have been allowed through this week, Martin, and yet these right-wing Israelis, we're going to have a listen to this report by John Irvine this week from ITV News, some of the right-wing Israelis have then been standing in front of the truck so that they can't actually proceed anywhere, and so they're stuck and no one is getting the aid. So let's have a listen to John Irvine's report on the starvation of Gaza this week.
Despite Israel lifting its aid blockade on Gaza, the UN says tonight that Palestinians are yet to receive the desperately needed supplies. Some trucks have now entered the territory, but the provisions remain stuck at a border crossing. That news will do little to improve Israel's international standing, nor will today's events in the West Bank. A number of diplomats, including British representatives, were forced to flee for cover when they came under fire in the city of Jenin.
In the West Bank city of Jenin today, Israeli soldiers opened fire, forcing a group of foreign diplomats to run for cover. The IDF says that the delegation deviated from an approved route. This is hardly a good look at a time when Israel is coming in for more and more international criticism. The airtight Israeli siege of Gaza is supposed to be over. However, some Israeli right-wingers have been trying to prevent aid lorries from entering the strip.
When there is a war, it doesn't matter who your enemy is. You need to destroy their offspring to prevent them from creating more offspring.
That right-wing Israeli at the end there, I mean, that's pretty... She said when there's a war and you've got to kill their offspring to prevent them creating more offspring. Now, this is genocide.
It is, and if the Palestinians were to say we've got to kill Jewish children, Israeli children, to prevent them growing up into Israeli soldiers, that would be regarded as an absolutely monstrous thing to say. Personally, I don't want to see any Israeli children killed, but I'd be very, very happy to see massive casualties in the Israeli army. They deserve a good hiding.
Why?
Because they shouldn't be doing what they're doing, Tony, and I'm not a pacifist like you.
Oh, what do you mean they should? Well, actually, I mean, a lot of what they're doing is combating other soldiers, or fighters, equivalent to them.
No, they're not. They're killing the civilians because they're too cowardly to go into the tunnels and take on the mass fighters. because then they take casualties. But if the Iranians join this battle in the next couple of weeks, they have got the hypersonic capability to massacre the Israeli army.
You'd like to see that, would you?
I'm afraid I would, Tony, yes. I've reached that point.
Yeah, well, you have been quite a while, actually.
Yeah.
Anyway, in a response to the killing of these two Israeli diplomats in Washington this week, we had a senator. His name's Randy Fine. He's a Republican senator from Florida. He had this to say. Have a close listen to this one, Martin.
The fact of the matter is the Palestinian cause is an evil one.
Yeah, and Congressman, there is a ceasefire deal on the table right now that the White House is hoping both Israel and Hamas will sign on to. Does this shooting change anything when it comes to the course of the war or the negotiations to end it?
Well, I think it speaks to the importance of the only end of the conflict is complete and total surrender by those who support Muslim terror. In World War II, we did not negotiate a surrender with the Nazis. We did not negotiate a surrender with the Japanese. We nuked the Japanese twice in order to get unconditional surrender. That needs to be the same here. There is something deeply, deeply wrong with this culture, and it needs to be defeated.
So he's talking about Muslims in general need to be defeated.
Muslim terror, he said.
Of course, and it's all based on what happened on 9/11, Tony, when the Muslims blew up the Twin Towers, except it wasn't the Muslims, it was the Israelis.
I want to know, does he know anything about Operation Cyclone and the Charlie Wilson's war and the whole concept of the Americans funding and the Saudis funding this extremist form of Islam?
Look at Gilani, who's now been welcomed, he's visiting Keir Starmer this week, and he's actually the head of Al-Qaeda, and he used to be a member of ISIS. But he's a good terrorist, because he's pro-Israel.
I don't know if this guy in the States... would want to have him nuked, would you? What do you think?
Well, the problem
maybe
is,
he's a bit confused.
Well, you know, it is confusing, because in actual fact, you know, if you start throwing nukes around, then you could get nuked yourself. And that's the problem.
Randy Fine thinks this is the only way out of it, is to nuke like the Americans did to the Japanese at the end of the war, just to bring an end to all the Muslim terror.
Well, I presume what we're talking about...
Maybe he wants to start World War III.
What we're talking about here, and this, and Sheldon Adelson, who's Miriam Adelson's husband, who's dead now, is quite clear about it. Why don't we just nuke Iran? Nuke them. Kill them all. Of course, the problem with that is that the Iranians are going to fire back, and they're going to kill as many... You know, they've got the capability to wreck Israeli society. If the Iranians go to war with the Israelis will lose. And, of course, if the Americans and the British join in on the Israeli side, they will lose. They're two aircraft carriers. Our aircraft carrier is now moving towards Diego Garcia as we speak, and there's always been rows this week about what's supposed to happen on to the Chagos Islanders. All of those aircraft carriers will be sunk with everybody on them. That's what World War III is
going to
look like.
What about all the Al-Qaeda people that came back from Syria and now living in this country? Will they join the Iranians in a war against Britain?
The Iranian people who've been arrested, the Iranians are Shia. And in actual fact, the Salafi Muslims, the Al-Qaeda, hate the Shia more than they hate anybody else. So they're definitely not going to join forces. And of course, what the West has been doing, the Israelis including, is helping, using the Saudi Arabians to create Salafist terror. And of course, the Iranian general staff, the Russian general staff, the Chinese general staff, they're all very well aware that Islamist terrorism is, in fact, a British, American, Israeli puppet.
Yeah, as we were hearing from David Livingstone last week, who's done a whole kind of history about it, and I think his book is Black Terror, White Soldiers, or is it Muslims versus Islam is his latest book. Anyway, we heard a little bit from John Irvine just now on ITV News about this right-wing demonstration trying to stop the aid lorries getting through. What about the opposite side? Because there are a whole bunch of Israeli citizens who are doing everything they possibly can to get this war stopped and stop it now. And it was lovely to see. If you looked at them, I haven't got the pictures here, obviously, but if you have a look at the pictures, you'll see there was a handful of the right-wing Israelis, maybe about 10 of them, stopping the lorries. This march is far, far bigger, hundreds.
Today, while our government, the Israeli government, launches another attack on Gaza, we are marching hundreds of people, Jews and Palestinians, from Sderot to the Gaza border with a demand to stop this assault on Gaza, to stop the horrible killing of innocent people and of children. And we are demanding our government to stop. cannot go on. This war has nothing with our safety. It's only about annexation and building more settlements and transferring the Palestinians, and we would not let it happen.
Yes, so there they are, and he's saying that it's actually about annexation. That's what they're really up. What he's saying there, that protester chappy there, the Israeli guy, saying we're Israelis, but we're with the Palestinians too, marching here, and what we're trying to stop, we realise that they're up to is this Greater Israel project. He didn't use the phrase, but he's talking about expansionism, isn't he? Settler projects and annexation.
Well, that's right, and they're absolutely upfront about it as well. It's not as if they're keeping it as a secret. And of course, you know, this undermines the whole principle of international law as codified since 1945, no aggressive land grabs. And of course, if you're going to pull the whole system down, then we're already in World War III, let's face it. And at the end of it, there will be a different hierarchy. Some will be up, some will be down. But it may well be at the end of World War III, the state of Israel simply won't exist.
We're going to have a little bit more analysis, but before that, let's go to Gaza itself, to northern Gaza, which is where the aid doesn't get through to, because it's coming through, is it the Rafah crossing, it's called, at the south, Martin?
Into Egypt, yeah.
Into Egypt, because that's where this aid is coming through. People like Fatima, who are in northern Gaza, they're getting virtually nothing at all. Here's her latest report, where she's looking at particularly at crimes against journalism. This absolutely is one of the number one issues, and she's quite right when she says never in the history of planet Earth have so many journalists been deliberately targeted and killed to cover up the war crimes.
Hi, this is Fatima reaching out to you from a corner of freedom in northern Gaza. Under the Zionist occupation forces' most intense reporting restrictions, journalists in the besieged Gaza Strip are under severe threat. The voices of the truth and those who speak for the oppressed are being silenced daily. More than 230 journalists have been killed by Israel occupation so far. Their only crime was reporting the suffering of their people. Despite international laws that protect journalists, Israel occupation continues these attacks with full support from Western governments, especially the United States. These powers turn a blind eye, allowing Israel to act with impunity. Gaza has become the most dangerous place in the world for journalists in human history. Many have been killed, injured, or forced to flee. Some were clearly marked as press when they were targeted, others killed in strikes on their homes or offices. This violates Article 79 of the Additional Protocol 1 of the Geneva Conventions, which protects journalists in conflict zones. Yet Israel faces no consequences. It has also blocked foreign media access, shut down communication networks, and restricted protective equipment, all to silence independent reporting. Just 2 days ago, journalist Hassan Slayah was assassinated while receiving treatment at the Nasser Medical Complex. He had been badly injured a month earlier when an Israeli airstrike hit a journalist's tent, leaving him with burns and a skull fracture. His killing has sparked outrage. He was widely respected for his work covering attacks on Gaza, including the genocide that took place since October 2023. This is not just a war on people. It is a war on truth. Journalists are not collateral damage. They are being targeted to remove witnesses. As Amnesty International said, Israeli forces have turned the occupied Gaza Strip into one of the most dangerous places on earth for media workers. To date, Israeli forces continue to enjoy impunity as they kill or intimidate Palestinian journalists, at times alongside their entire families. Groups like the Committee to Protect Journalists and Reporters Without Borders have confirmed that some journalists were deliberately targeted, raising serious concerns of media suppression. Silence in the face of this deliberate attack is complicity. The world must act now to defend the truth, protect the press, and stand with the people of Gaza. Cameras and bins should not be met with bullets. The goal of these killings is clear, to hide the crimes and erase the voices of a people facing extermination.
So that's Fatima, exclusive report. So I feel so humbled and privileged that she's able to get those reports out, Martin. As we know, of course, Wafa Aludeini, who had been doing that for this programme, giving us some exclusive reports as well. In the early stages, it was killed in the middle of last year. Others have taken up the baton. They know, people like this know, Martin, that just by giving a little podcast, a piddling little podcast like ours, a report like that, they could be killed without a second thought by the Israelis. I mean, this is, of course, what they're doing is they're just trying to cover up their own crime. And they think that by their control of the media in the West here, that they can manage to get away with it.
Well, they are, aren't they? Jonathan Cook's wrote an interesting article this week, because he's Bristol-based, about the complicity of Starmer government and what's going on.
And the BBC.
And, of course, the US government is absolutely bathed in blood. Trump's hands are absolutely saturated.
We've had a certain Gary Lineker. We don't often mention him on this programme. He's just announced he's going to retire from Match of the Day after, God knows, is it 30? I don't know, 25 years or something. There's a lot of people saying maybe that this has got to do with his position on Palestine, Martin.
Well, it certainly is. He retweeted something which the Israeli lobby said was anti-Semitic, and that on that basis his career with the BBC is over. And lots of people who speak out about what's going on are losing their jobs, are being persecuted. You know, this is a moment of truth for lots of people,
isn't
it? It is,
and this week, Piers Morgan and Loki, I think, actually, no, it's not Piers Morgan, I think it's George Galloway with Loki talking about Piers Morgan, but they bring up the Lineker topic too, and Loki gets into some superb detail about how the genocidalists have got their tendrils right into BBC.
Now, in terms of the Gary Lineker question, we have to remember, George, that Gary Lineker has been subject to an Israel lobby campaign, you know, as the highest paid employee of the BBC. He was subject to this campaign for several years. Now, that campaign was led by UK Lawyers for Israel, which, it has to be remembered, when it was originally registered on Companies House in October 2010, it was registered as, quote unquote, Action for Peace. However, in May 2011, the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs had a post on its site dedicated solely to the creation of the UK Lawyers for Israel. It later on, of course, hosted a two-day seminar with the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Israeli Embassy in London, and, of course, hosted several speakers from the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It is essentially an arm of the Israeli government. And the head of this organization, which has militated against Gary Lineker for so many years, Jonathan Turner, actually has gone on record as saying that the blockade of Gaza will actually help decrease obesity and thus increase life expectancy in Gaza. Just so you have an understanding of what type of maniacs we are actually dealing with. UK Lawyers for Israel went as far as bullying an NHS hospital to take, or lobbying an NHS hospital, I should say, to take children from Gaza's artwork out of the hospital. I mean, it's just beyond belief. They've even had a role in editing textbooks in this country on the content that relates to Palestine. But the bigger question, George, as you will well know, is what exactly is happening at the BBC. Now, you have to remember that currently in a key position at the BBC, in charge of, according to the BBC website, upholding and protecting the independence of the BBC, is Robbie Gibb. Now, who is Robbie Gibb? Robbie Gibb is, simultaneous to his job at the BBC, the sole director and owner of Jewish Chronicle Media. Now, the Jewish Chronicle, which was found to be producing stories that seem to come directly from Benjamin Netanyahu's office, is a well-established pro-Israel smear factory, which has smeared yourself, I'm sure, hundreds of times, smeared me tens of times, and pretty much anyone who supports the Palestinian cause has, of course, been written about in derisive tones by the Jewish Chronicle. Now, surely that is a clear conflict of interest for Robbie Gibb to have this role at the BBC, supposedly upholding independence, at the same time as being the director and owner of the Jewish Chronicle. But his conflicts of interest actually go farther, George. So on his personal declaration of private interests, Robbie Gibb stated that he currently has a job at Kesk CNC, which is a PR company. So he's employed by this PR company, which was founded by a chairman of the Weizmann Institute in Israel, Gershon Kesk, at the same time as he's employed by the BBC. Surely, being employed by a PR company and a news company, these things would rub up against each other. But what also needs to be stated is that Kesk is a subsidiary of the Publicis Group. Now, the Publicis Group, according to its CEO, has staff that are currently in the Israeli military fighting in Gaza. Again, a massive conflict of interest. Also, Gibb has a paid role at JL Partners, which was founded by James Johnson, a pollster for Theresa May, and Tom Lubbock, a former pollster for the Conservative Party under Boris Johnson. But then you get to the question of the BBC's online Middle East editor, the very individual behind those headlines, which essentially put Palestinian deaths at the hands of Israeli soldiers in the passive voice and work to sort of invisibilize the Israeli bombs that fall on Palestinians. Well, who is that? That is Rafi Berg. Now, Rafi Berg is somebody that collaborated with Israeli intelligence personnel in order to write a book about them, and then was so happy with Benjamin Netanyahu's response that he framed the letter from Benjamin Netanyahu and put it on his wall. And that's right next to a framed picture of himself with the Israeli ambassador to the UK at the time, Mark Regev.
So that's Loki speaking to George Galloway. George Galloway didn't get a word in edgeways, did he?
No, I think he was allowing Loki to show off the research that he's done there.
And of course, George wasn't interrupting him as much as I interrupt you.
No.
So anyway, I mean, he's done a pretty good job there, I think, of digging out, particularly this character, Robbie Gibb. I have heard his name before. I mean, the Jewish Chronicle is a particularly nasty piece of work. I mean, it obviously has nothing to do with upholding the independence of the BBC. This guy can't do that. He's already Jewish Chronicle man who's already been discredited this year. Last year, actually, I think it was.
Yeah, well, the Jewish Chronicle has been taken successfully to court several times for basically telling fibs. And it's extraordinary that the BBC, you know, for Gary Lineker, for, you know, basically making a small... The tweet that he retweeted had a rat emoji on it. And, of course, the Zionist lobby said, oh, that's just a reference to Jews as rats. And, of course, he hadn't even noticed that there was an emoji on it. But of course, what they've been determined to get rid of him for years, and they've managed to get rid of him. Meanwhile, their guy is ensconced inside the BBC, basically trying to spin everything that comes out of Israel in the way that they want it spun.
Well, it doesn't stop there, because David Miller has been looking at Novara Media this week. He is the Bristol-based sociology professor who was kicked out of his job and has won compensation, but now the Bristol University is using its money not just to build masses and masses of student blocks with the tiny little pigeon spaces for the students all around Bristol everywhere you go, but they're also using some of that money to counter-sue David Miller. But here's David talking about Novara Media, and he takes a very good look at, in fact, he ran for many years a brilliant website which is still out there called Spinwatch. It's also another one called Powerbase, which looks at the so-called experts that we see on the TV and various other organisations to find out, actually, look, they're being funded by these people, and they're really just some sort of lobby rather than some independent expert. But anyway, Novara Media come in for a bit of scrutiny by David Miller this time.
You mentioned Novara Media and how it's also in cahoots with Standing Together to some extent, which is quite shocking, because I think a lot of us do turn to those forms of media right now on YouTube, especially Novara Media. It's very popular with my dad to get the correct information. So how do they manage to put up such a front? I wanted to ask, I was just curious, how do they manage to put up such a front with so pro-Palestinian content, and yet there's still this funding going? Did you say, was it funding that they fund Novara Media?
Yeah, so Novara Media has been funded by the Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung from Germany. No, look, I mean, I've been talking about the Zionist movement and about Zionist infiltration, I suppose, is the way I would see it. But we've got to understand that in the force field and the ecosystem of all these organizations, that we also have other organizations involved, other state-linked organizations involved. So, for example, you know, there's an example. The example I mentioned before, an organization called the Balfour Project in Edinburgh, which is not, it doesn't have people in it. Well, there's one or two people on the edges of it who are directly in Zionist movement, but the rest of them are more people who are driving it are more connected to the British foreign policy elite. And when I say the British foreign policy elite, that's kind of code for MI6, right? So. So you've got to think about the role of intelligence agencies in trying to manage and manipulate debates. And that, of course, is part of the function of MI6 and indeed, of course, of the CIA through the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, and indeed through USAID, which, of course, Trump famously squashed the budgets of some months ago, although they're now about to, or the NED at least, have had them opened up again. So, and that, of course, is also the case with the Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung, which you know is pursuing, to some extent, the interests of foreign policy interests, i.e., the German intelligence agencies' interests. So you've got to think about it in those kinds of terms as well. So you know, I mean, obviously, Navarra is partly in that kind of orbit as well. We've seen in over the last five or six, in fact, longer now, years. The role of MI6 in public debate becoming more and more clear with a whole series of leaks, the Integrity Initiative leaks, this organization which was there which was funded by MI6, which was overseen by MI6, but which was run by British military intelligence and which was there to counter Russian propaganda and spent most of its time attacking Jeremy Corbyn. Now, that was exposed by a huge leak of documents, and there's been very many more leaks like that on showing the role of MI6, for example, in the Palestinian refugee camps in Beirut, in Syria, in the dirty war in Syria, and the attempt to change the regime in Syria, which of course they've now done and put their man, the CIA's man, in charge, Jelani. And so this is all the way through this, that it's not just the Zionist movement, it's also Western intelligence agencies who play secretive, covert, and but sometimes exposed roles in managing public debate. And they, of course, the British intelligence agencies are involved in trying to manage debate on Palestine, as well as it being the case, in my view, that the Zionists have been able to penetrate some elements of the British security state, for example, I would say the police, for example, the fact that all government departments have adopted the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance working definition of anti-Semitism, which is a Zionist entity foreign policy instrument. So that all of that is an indication of that there are very many powers arraigned against us, and we need to be much more, I think, clued up and less naive about our enemy, because our enemy is not just the people who are making the drones in the Elbit factories. It's not just the IDF, the guys who go from Manchester or Birmingham or Glasgow or London to shoot Palestinian children in the head. It's not just them. It's a whole range of other actors who seem like they're normal people, who seem like they are simply British citizens, but who are actually engaged in trying to subvert our movements. And of course, that involves the police, and it involves the intelligence services, and it involves a whole series of other governmental organisations, and indeed of NGOs, of think tanks, of Zionist family foundations, which fund all this stuff. So we face quite an array of enemies, to be fair.
I mean, he's basically saying, that's David Miller there, talking about well, it was about Novara Media, as well as and he's Ronnie Barkan is on that as well, who standing together is an organization which is trying to say people like David Miller shouldn't be allowed to speak at Palestine marches. But what he's saying is almost all of these organizations are funded by somebody. Particularly media, Martin, and the German intelligence apparently are behind the funding of Navarra Media.
Well, I mean, you know, we know that there's a massive psychological warfare campaign being conducted, and that requires resources, and some of those resources are private resources, like those of Miriam Adelson. She's, you know, made her money out from casinos and so on. Some of it are public resources. We fund, through MI6 and various other means, the propaganda with which we're propagandized. So they look at the white helmets, basically a creature of MI6 paid for by us, and then they're wheeled out as you know, local people telling us, please invade our country and help us. But we've paid the British taxpayers' money has been given to those people to say that, and then it's presented in our media as if this is a genuinely independent force of people who have got a genuine point of view, but it's actual fact it's all manipulation by our own security services. Oh,
well, I'd just like to clear up one item from last week, and that is where we had Lynch and Morrison. Who was the guy who was the Republican News editor?
Danny Morris.
Yeah. Because we kind of left that hanging. And what I'll do is I'll put up a clip. It's actually quite long. The reason I had to cut it is because it was too long, really, to play at the end of the show. But what happens is he goes into this, just to finish the story off, it's a bit mean of me to still stop that cliffhanger at the end of the show, Morrison goes into this house where apparently there's going to be a conference with this guy who's just confessed to being spied for the British. And the whole place is then raided by the British Army, and he manages to get into over the garden wall into the house next door. But this is the sort of thing that went on in Northern Ireland, doesn't it, Martin? The idea was that this guy is an editor of a newspaper. He's helping the IRA with their publicity. We want to take him out and put him in jail.
Well, they also just assassinated people. You know, lots of people just ended up dead. And that's the democratic society we live in, folks.
If we go back a little bit to first Gulf War, to the invasion of Iraq, there was I don't know if you've come across this ever. The first time I've seen it this week, but it's a guy called, he was working for Bell Pottinger, Martin Welks. It might just be my spelling mistake. Wells, maybe. Welks doesn't sound necessarily like a normal surname. But anyway, he was recruited and sent over to Iraq to produce loads of propaganda. And I found it absolutely fascinating that the whole point of his job, working for Bell Pottinger, all CIA, MI6 funded, was to produce these video shorts that would go on the news and also would be circulated amongst the local people. And they would think that it was something that was produced locally. In fact, it was. But by the British secret services.
We've got to use Al-Qaeda's footage and all their propaganda out there to do it. We need it to be 10 minutes long, and it needs to be in this file format, and we need to encode it in this manner. And, yeah, that's great. And we're going to track it via Google Analytics. All the VCDs that were made, and quite a considerable amount, were taken by Marines when they were going into various villages, or they were doing raids, whatever patrols they were on, and they were dispersed that way. That was the quickest, easiest, and also, I guess, the most sensible way of doing it, because if they're raiding a house and they're going to make a mess of it looking for stuff anyway, they just drop an odd VCD there, then when whoever comes back, they're going to pick it up and they're going to start checking stuff through. So it kind of made sense to do it that way. And these were discs that were made to play in a thing called Real Player. And what happened to a Real Player is you'd get a white screen before anything would happen. They came up with this ingenious idea that within the white flash that Real Player does, it actually tracks where the VCD is being played. Because Real Player has to connect online to run, that little bit of code would then be connected to a Google Analytics account, and so that way you could have a track and know where that VCD is being played. So when the VCD has been delivered, when they're watched and the tracking kicks, it makes a hit with analytics, and when you log into it 24 hours later, it will tell you which IP address and where in the world it's been looked at. So, for instance, if one's looked at in the middle of Baghdad, okay, you know there's a hit there. If one 48 hours later or a week later shows up in another part of the world, then that's the more interesting one. And that's what they're looking for more. Because then that gives you a trail of, okay, so someone sent it to this person, or they've been here and they've gone elsewhere. So it gives you a track of somebody who could possibly be a threat. Some of the VCDs ended up in some interesting countries. I think I had a couple in Iran. Obviously, in Iraq, in several places. I think there was one in Syria, but the most interesting one was in America. No idea how it got there. But all my job was to do was to collate that data and pass it on. So I would do a printout for the day, and if anything interesting popped up, hand it over to the bosses, and then it would be dealt with from there. When we made something, the process would be, I would show it to my producer, they'd be happy with it. We would then get in seniors in the office, they'd be happy with it. Then we get the two colonels in to look at it, look at the things we'd done throughout the day. They'd be fine with it. It would then go to General Petraeus. He would then look at it and his team would look at it. And if they're happy with it, it would then go on up the line if it needed to. If he couldn't sign off on it, it would go up on the line to the White House. And then it was signed off up there and the answer would come back down the line. I was in and out of Baghdad on this contract for over a year or so. I just couldn't do it any longer. When you've got over 500 tapes with more atrocities than you can believe could ever be committed to another human being on, there's only so much you can take.
Yeah, so there he is, Martin Welks, working for Bell Pottinger, recruited in London, sent straight over there. Martin, he said it wasn't really like a job interview. I just walked into the room and they told me I got the job.
Well, I mean, the way in which these hidden networks actually function is always of interest, of course. But nobody, also fascinating to hear themselves that they don't exist.
The technical side of that is very interesting, isn't it? The idea, as soon as you try and play this thing, your computer quickly hooks up if it's online and will tell them whereabouts you're watching it in the world. So he's looking at, and Google, of course, is being complicit in all that. It's telling the military, right, someone has used Google here. Obviously, Google really is more like a front end for the military.
Well, that's right. But as we've often said, the Taliban were able to win in Afghanistan because large parts of Afghanistan have got no electricity. So all of this electronic stuff just doesn't work. And the same was true of the Nepalese rebels Maoist rebels in Nepal. In large areas of Nepal, there's no electricity. So this normal method of tracking everybody just doesn't work.
Okay, well, last tonight, we're going to have an interview. We're going to hear from Bonnie Flores over in New Zealand. She has an absolutely shocking tale to tell. You know the census forms that you fill in once every decade, Martin?
Yes.
Do you fill your census form in and send it in dutifully?
I did the last time it came out. Yes.
These things have been going a long time, haven't they? I think Mary and Joseph had to go to Bethlehem from Nazareth to fill in a census form back in 0 BC AD, didn't they?
Well, yes. I mean, the censuses are something that governments do. That's, we wouldn't have any statistics at all.
Well, that's
do things
where
like this, wouldn't
you're wrong. No more, because apparently in New Zealand they've got a new system that Stats NZ is coming up with, which it won't. You won't need to have a census anymore because the whole thing, all your data, will be being collected anyway in real time. And isn't that a wonderful idea? They're just going to keep collecting all your data, no privacy anymore, and so you won't have to fill out a census form. Anyway, Bonnie has been looking into this. Even though this is happening in New Zealand, there's been absolutely no scrutiny except by people like her, freelance journalists.
I was introduced to an insider who had some concerns about what was going on at StatsNZ, which is our official statistics agency. And based on what he said, we worked on some Official Information Act requests to sort of flush out what was going on. But what it turned out was that StatsNZ has been busy creating a sort of everything database. They call it a integrated data system or a statistical register. That's what it's called in those kind of the jargon, I suppose. But essentially, it's an everything database. I mean, that's not unusual for government agencies to collect data on us, and they all do that. But essentially what it's doing is it's going to be linking all of these agencies' data, and it's then going to be moving from moments in time, updates, you know, refreshes that happen maybe three or four times a year traditionally, where the new information is loaded in, to real time updates of all our data across government agencies in real time. So they're linking not only population register, which they're upgrading at the moment, but they're also linking business registers and location registers. So they're sort of developing a kind of 360 real-time vision of the entire population, anyone born in the country or who's become a citizen. And they're, on top of that, they're going to, or they are, they're sort of, it's hard to say how far through the project they are, but they're some way through, at least half, I would say. They're creating what they call a persistent unique identifier. So, I mean, every government agency would have an anonymized identifier for the information it holds on a person, but this would be one identifier that follows you and tracks you, the individual, over time, from birth to death, potentially. Well, that would be the idea. That's what it would be capable of doing. It is, in theory, anonymized, as all sort of, you know, government statistics should be, but people I spoke to said that, you know, it doesn't take much with large language models to identify a person with really just a few data points. So it's hard to see how privacy is respected.
Maybe we could talk about privacy in a minute, but first, the first question is why? Why do they need this?
Well, what they say it's for is research and statistical purposes. But they already gathered statistical data through census, and the research, so that's how they're selling it. Use cases for various agencies to do planning, projections, and for academics with the correct authorization. It's a very powerful database, so researchers that are allowed to use it, you know, they relish that. Even my insider said she thought the data was amazing. But, you know, she was worried about what could be done with it.
Now, the Roman Empire did censuses, the Nazis did censuses, and particularly in the 1930s, the concern should be that this information can be abused by a new government, a new regime that decides to weaponise it against people. Say, for example, if you put down that you were Jewish in the 1930s, at the beginning of the Nazi era, you might think nothing of it. But then you found that the SS were banging on your door, the Gestapo. So are there any kind of guarantees that this is not going to be abused by governments? And also, of course, you know, this information, there's a whole industry out there called the data mining industry, which steals this information and then sells it on.
Yeah. No, there are no guarantees. One of the things I've had trouble establishing is the legality of it. I put questions to StatsNZ because there are two government acts that are involved. There's the Privacy Act, and then there is the Data and Statistics Act 2022, which is a newer version of the older Statistics Act, but granting a lot more data acquisition powers to the chief statistician. And no, it doesn't. Stats couldn't tell me very quickly and in plain language which parts, which clauses of the Privacy Act and the Data and Statistics Act made what it was doing legal. We all know about the IDI, the original research database, but this upgrade and this linking of other databases together and then the move into real time is not something that it has been transparent or upfront about. It has not front-footed this with a public relations campaign or an information campaign to let people know that's what it's doing and seek at least a bit of social license. So, no, I can't see that there are guarantees. Even my questions to the Privacy Commissioner were sort of fobbed off. But the privacy commissioner is, you know, notoriously underfunded and overworked, and, you know, that's possibly on purpose. So I can't see where the protections are. Even the privacy law expert I spoke to wasn't sure about the legality. No one has been able to tell me how it's legal. So I don't think anyone's in a position to tell me how it's also protective of people's privacy rights.
Well, look, you've dropped a little bombshell there, which is that there hasn't been a publicity campaign, because obviously this is a massive infringement on people's privacy. Surely there's a raging national debate about it.
you would think so, Tony. It's flown under the radar since it dropped. There is no discussion now. And actually, I interviewed a former chief statistician who was chief statistician in the 90s, and he was pretty appalled at the goings-on at StatsNZ, and one of his main criticisms was its lack of transparency. Even reviews that it has done into failed censuses and things that are, you know, unpublished months or years later, which, you know, the way he characterised his role when he was, you know, the chief statistician, was that the public trust was basically the basis for that role, and without it, and without the confidence of the minister, there wasn't really any statutory basis for the role. You know, that's what it relies on, and we seem to be moving away from that. Yeah.
So that's Bonnie Flores speaking to me earlier this week, freelance journalist over in New Zealand, doing some sterling work for nothing most of the time. On her Substack, so I'll put some links up to the full version of that, and to her Substack on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, as I will also, of course, to the interview with Steve Hall. But Martin, this is amazing, isn't it? This technology is so cool. You can just keep an eye on everybody in real time, and the government's going to have a massive computer database wearing away, keeping an eye on all your statistics, probably, you know, your body temperature, what you're spending your money on, your religion, and everything in real time now.
Well, isn't it interesting that Edward Snowden was able to download onto an MP3 all of the crown jewels.
You mean a flash drive?
Flash drive of a national security agency. Now, what happens if you've got this surveillance net is that somebody can actually steal it off you. So imagine that your government has got all of this information on you. What if, say, your enemy government, the Russians, just do a couple of little clicks, and they've got all that information.
Well, you know what? Who will be getting this information? I can absolutely guarantee it without one shadow of a doubt is Alex Karp. Remember that guy we heard last week, the boss of Palantir, saying how there's something wrong with you. You obviously, you know, something wrong with you if you support Palestinians because they're maniacs and terrorists. And he is the owner of Palantir, which is this massive database company. Inspired by the, in this rather perverse accelerationist fashion, by the Palantirs in the Lord of the Rings book by Tolkien. And his Palantir company is exactly after all this sort of information. So they can just do all these checks on people, almost as if they're checking on cattle on the farm.
Well, I mean, we've all seen the film V, isn't it, with Stephen Fry in it. I mean, the fear of total surveillance has always been there. It's a kind of, it's been hanging over.
It's a
over
very good rational fear. Sensible thing to be afraid of, because that people can, I mean, we've seen how the Nazis weaponized IBM and the Hollerith machines in the Second World War to round people up, round Jews up, etc.
They've been using AI in targeting in Gaza, haven't they? Well, I mean, you know, there's going to be a showdown about all of these things, isn't there?
Anyway, well done, Bonnie, for digging it out. Apparently, New Zealand is the place where they're going to be trying out certain things that we'll be bringing here soon. So maybe this has already started as some sort of secret government program here at the National Office for Statistics in Whitehall, but no one has actually been told about it. Anyway, fantastic job she's done. Well done, Bonnie. And we're going to finish this week with a sort of flashback, in a way, Well, to last week's, I don't know if listeners have listened all the way through David Livingstone's interview last week, but there was some fascinating stuff to say. I found it amazing, actually, about the, well, I mean, he didn't call it the Mark Masons, but anyone that knows anything about Freemasonry knows that once you've done the first 3 degrees of Freemasonry, you can go on to various different branches of the Masons, or several at the same time. The Mark Masons are the one, if you want to look at their rituals, if you can, they're all to do with building Solomon's Temple. There's something a bit sniffy about this, Martin, isn't it? These Freemasons have been around, whatever, 300, 400 years or so, and all of these little rituals that they do, some, many of them anyway, all say, are we going to rebuild Solomon's Temple? Well, isn't that funny? Because that's exactly what the Zionists want to do. Isn't that a coincidence?
Well, I mean, the Solomon's Temple has been part of Western culture ever since the Bible became a book. And
so is it a coincidence, do you think?
Well, I mean, the Masons, of course, model, you know, they're part product of Western culture, so they obviously absorb all this stuff which is already lying around to be absorbed. You know,
These rituals were drawn up, many of them, in the 18th century, or maybe even 17th century, because masons around the Civil War.
Yes, and of course, the modern Masons, which were created in that era, pretended that they had secret knowledge that went back to ancient Egypt, but it was pretense. They didn't really. They were just making stuff up because people do. And
it's all very biblical. Maybe that they, and also of course Solomon, as I point out, I think in this clip, he was one of the kings that fell from grace. He basically sold out. Anyway, thank you very much, Martin. We'll say goodbye to you now. You can trot off, and we'll have a listen now to a little clip from David Livingstone talking about this mad stuff to do with the Masons and their little Solomon Temple building rituals.
The Masonic initiation rites, almost all of them, and particularly I think it's the third degree, which is, you know, that's supposed to be which is the one where you get hit gently, supposedly anyway, right, on the head by a mallet, and you're supposed to fall back into a coffin as a ritual death, basically. And in fact, of course, this is a threat of death against the candidate. There's a lot of talk about Hiram Abiff, who was a Phoenician who was invited by Solomon to come and build his temple. And there's a lot of talk about Solomon's temple too. So this is, it seems to me, hardly mentioned that this is what the Zionists plan to do. They do plan to rebuild Solomon's temple. And there it is, right in the middle of this Masonic ritual, going back 350-odd years at least.
Right. Exactly.
I wonder, is there anything in Islam which does take a similar edict against these oath swearing and joining these cults?
Well, not that specifically, but there's basically, there's a verse. What's interesting, this is why I pointed out to Muslims, is that the first chapter of the Quran is sort of the equivalent of the Lord's Prayer. It's very short. The second chapter is the longest chapter, and the first hundred verses, most of it focuses on the Jews. So to show that the Jews were the first to have received the revelation, they were the first to receive, extensive blessings from God, but speaks to their sort of repeated rebellion and blasphemies, which is effectively the story of the Old Testament. And then it introduces, after almost 100 verses, the claim that among them, there's a group who apostatized, and they did so by learning magic from the sort of angels who were referred to as Harut and Marut. The Quran corrects that in reality they were learning magic from Satanists who attributed those teachings to Solomon. And the legend is that in Islamic tradition is that because in Islam the teaching is that Solomon was able, I mean, same thing I think is in the Bible, is that Solomon was able to build a magnificent temple. It's supposed to be the most extraordinary temple in history with all kinds of scientific marvels. And, but he was given control over jinn. So what's jinn basically is their spirit, they are non-material entities. This, I think we've talked about this before. The idea of spirits is an idea that you'll find, I think, pretty much everywhere in the world. Western society is probably the only society who's rejected that belief. Instead, we have ETs. But these are beings that have free will. So the devil is apparently one of these beings, and he rebelled against God. So they're just not made of matter. They're made of presumably maybe energy or something like that.
Well, yeah, so anyway, we're talking about angels and demons.
Right. So effectively what we call demons, but they're not born evil. It's just that they're not evil by nature. They have free will, and some of them are bad. So he was able to control these jinn, a number of them, to help him in the construction of his temple. And apparently they hid a number of magical books under Solomon's throne, so that when Solomon died, those books were discovered and were falsely attributed to him. So, but in parallel, a similar legend, well, the legend of Solomon's skill in magic survived in Judaism, right? So this is why apparently the legend is that he was able to control the demons through a ring that had a sigil on it, which was what they call a seal of Solomon, which was a six-pointed star, right? So the idea is basically that Solomon used demonic magic to be able to build the third temple through control of demons using the seal, the six-pointed star. And the idea is that the Masons have inherited the magical traditions of Solomon to now build the third temple.
So David Livingstone's explanation, I'm not sure, the Seal of Solomon, I think, is actually something like a nine-pointed star, not a six-pointed, you know, the hexagram, which is obviously on the Israeli flag. So I think the Seal of Solomon might actually be slightly different from that. But anyway, it's great to have somebody kind of pulling all that stuff apart for us, even if it was last week. And you may have well have heard that if you've listened to the full interview. I just think it's been one of our best yet, really, drilling into this whole sort of fakery and the Gnosticism to do with creating these completely opposite versions of Islam and Judaism, and a kind of similar thing with Christianity and Christian Zionism, to create a third world war and create Armageddon and create a religious war. In fact, many echoes, of course, with the dirty war in Northern Ireland and the use misuse of religion over there. So before we go, an ode from Patrizia. Me, myself, I, and other musings. From Russia with love, Rand made her way to write and speak and have her say. In books and scripts, she glorified wealth. Me, and I found Ain herself. No truck Rand gave for the greater good, each for themselves she understood. The fountainhead her book then landed, for scholars in pursuit of self she handed. No faith in God or intuition, no patience with an inner vision, just dollar signs and all that brings, from poverty oft brings such things. Rand's dream of life where greed is good, while governments in background should. Nick Land, a man of thin disguise, TG a pal in times gone by, Land's using boozing rumours told, lay wait to all his musings bold. Gobbledygook come hook or crook, in lines, in words, in every book, in stream of letters to river sea, washed overboard for all who be sycophants to this Cummings type, dig deep and find a load of tripe. Musing, boozing, words absurd, Nick Land on sand in every word, come hither, dither, ne'er-do-wells, when all else fails, Nick Land foretells tall tales, so folks will read and muse on phony baloney without a clue. Transgressive stuff, obsessed with those now gone before, mere goths, God knows, tortured, wailing, techno-babble, in parks with cider, boring rabble. No depth or width, just words spewed out, self-hatred, angst of this, no doubt. Thank you. Thank you very much, Patrizia. Funny as well, isn't it, that the Rand, Ayn Rand is what you're writing about there, but the RAND Corporation kind of appeared around about the same time, which is this kind of bizarre think tank that tries to create loads of wars all the time. And the idea, of course, is just to make America dominate the world. I think they've for a long time been preparing to have this big battle with China. That's what it seems to be mostly about. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Sorry, guys. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also, particularly, of course, to Dr. Vernon Coleman and to Bonnie Flores over in New Zealand, as well as Steve Hall, author of The Death of the Left. Fantastic stuff. I'll be putting those up on our show page later tonight, the full versions of the interview, if you want to dig a bit deeper, as Patricia might say. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Also, mustn't forget to thank Dave Bazanko, our sound engineer. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel via Not the BCFM Politics show page, which includes the podcast, full-length interviews, story tips, and comment page. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, you can donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. And you don't have to use PayPal. You can actually pay it into a proper bank account if you want. My paperbacks, Traitors of Arnhem and The Siege of Heaven Reader. The Traitors of Arnhem is all about the links between Hitler's private secretary and Churchill's private secretary during World War II and the taking of all the Nazi money in the form of Martin Bormann out of Berlin and into London by Desmond Morton. And those, that lot at the end of the Second World War, they're both, the easiest place to find those is on www.bilderberg.org, and you'll find links to either, but download electronic versions. Free versions are also there as free PDF, which has got not such good pictures in it, or you can even buy a paperback copy of those. And the Siege of Heaven Reader's got lots of stuff. It's basically a anthology of secret government. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. At least we're hoping to. Messing about with it a little bit this week to put the auto DJ on, we hope. We've been streaming from Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app for Android and Apple, available via the show page, not on Google Play, of course. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable bank holiday weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show from maybe the same, maybe another corner of freedom somewhere in the Temple of Port of Bristol next Friday at 5 p.m. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Sleep is still in my eyes, the dream is still in my head. I heave a sigh and sadly smile and lie a while in bed. I wish that it might come to pass, not fade like all my dreams.
that something that the British government is looking at, the idea of a vaccine passport specifically to allow people to come and go in the months ahead?
No, we're not. Vaccines are not mandated in this country, as Boris Johnson's quite rightly reminded Parliament. You know, that's not how we do things in the UK. We do them by consent. We yet don't know what the impact of vaccines on transmission is, and it would be discriminatory.
Hey, yo, they lie and they cheat. They were born to deceive. In the land of the lost, they mislead the naive. Gotta turn the telly off, cause it keeps you asleep. The reason for this pandemic is a digital idea. Yo, they lie and they cheat. We follow like we're sheep in a Freemasonic system. They don't want us free. The age of Aquarius, the rise of machines. We have to rebel and fight the digital ID. Ayo, how many times have they fed us lies and gone back on their word and then tried to deny? How many times have they committed crimes against humanity for the greater good, but yo, we got disguised? How many times are we gonna ignore the signs? Without the passport, you can't buy food because you get declined. How many times will you get pushed until you grow a spine? We live in a society where blind will lead the blind. We've entered a new age. They're priming us like souffle. They're trying to introduce a credit system like it's doomsday. I don't care if you think I'm crazy. I might sound it to you. They got the old order, now upgrading it to new. There's no conspiracy, it's here to see. I don't know how you can't agree. Digital ID is what the Bible calls mark of the beast. And I ain't down with that. That's why I'm taking to the streets. There's so much negativity. I'm trying to balance it with peace. Yo, they lie and they cheat. They were born to deceive. In the land of the lost, they mislead the naive. Gotta turn the telly off, cause it keeps you asleep. The reason for this pandemic is a digital idea. Yo, they lie and they cheat. We follow like we're sheep in a Freemasonic system. They don't want us free. The age of Aquarius, the rise of machines. We have to rebel and fight the digital ID. We've all seen the films. They're programming the people, conditioning them to accept the next part of the sequel. All they want is a predictable society. They want obedience and want you to comply with the elite. But I ain't having it. I've always been the blackest sheep. I'm banging on this system, seeing cracks in the concrete. I'll never give up. Yo, I'll never retreat. That's why you'll catch me with my megaphone up in the street. Shops soon cashless. They want it digitalized. They want to merge it with your passport that's being designed. You can dismiss it as conspiracy, but show me the light. Technocracy is coming. You gotta open your eyes. These lot of psychos, they need us. We don't need them. Even the Terminator told you himself.
Screw your freedom.
We think we're free, but we live in tyranny. I'd rather stand for something than to live on my knees. Ayo, they lie and they cheat. They were born to deceive. In the land of the lost, they mislead the naive. Gotta turn the telly off, cause it keeps you asleep. The reason for this pandemic is a digital idea. Ayo, they lie and they cheat. We follow like we're sheep in a Freemasonic system. They don't want us free. The age of Aquarius, the rise of machines. We have to rebel and fight the digital ID.
Okay, so there won't be a vaccine passport?
No, that's not being planned.
At all, ever.
Well,
not happening, zipped, and I don't know.
I certainly am not planning to introduce any vaccine passports.
Eventually, there will be sort of this digital immunity proof that, you know, will help facilitate the global reopening up.
So happy down Bethnal Green, this gay youth you might have seen. Tompkins and I with his girl between. Oh, what a surprise! I praised the Conservatives frank and free. Tompkins got angry so speedily. All in a moment he handed to me two lovely black eyes. Two lovely black eyes. Oh, what a surprise! Only for telling a man he was wrong. Two lovely black eyes. Next time I argued, I thought it best to give the Conservative side a rest. The merits of liberals I freely pressed. When, oh, what a surprise! The chap I had met was a Tory true. Nothing the Liberals' rights could do. This was my share of that argument too. Two lovely black eyes. Two lovely black eyes. Oh, what a surprise. Only for telling a man he was wrong. Two lovely black eyes. Now this song being nothing if not moral, the moral you caught I can hardly doubt. Never on politics rave and shout. leave it to others to fight it out, if you would be wise. Better, far better it is to let Liberals and Tories alone, you bet, and if you're willing and anxious to get two lovely black eyes, two lovely black eyes. Oh, what a surprise, only for telling a man he was wrong. Two lovely black eyes, all together, two lovely black eyes. Oh, what a surprise, only for telling a man he was wrong.